Tonight on The Good Atheist, we join Chris Tenz as he tells us about his life. He's the guy that's making the soundtrack for this thing. Enjoy! Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net bonus podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Chris Tenz.
Welcome to the show, Chris. This week I have a special guest. Now, as some of you may have heard, because I kind of said that I would do this, I promised that there would be a Bible story on Noah. This is supposed to be this show, and I'm here to disappoint you. But to make up for that disappointment,
how very godlike of you, Jacob.
Well, you don't even know how often, Chris, yeah. I make promises
false
and never deliver
promises,
them.
Yeah.
I am really, honestly, I'm just, yeah, right there. I suppose we share that quality, false promises. But to the point, I have a special treat, actually, because Chris has agreed to actually soundtrack this episode, and this is going to be a preview of what we're working on, because Bible stories is kind of like really taking off. People really are enjoying it, so I've decided that I was going to take all the stories that are part of the bonus shows, and I'm going to arrange them into a gigantic, comprehensive, here's Jacob reading the Bible kind of thing. It's not James Earl Jones, it's Jake doing it, but I'm not going to read from it. What a waste of time. I'm going to tell you what it's all about. I'm going to do what the Bible stories have always been, where I'm like, I'm going to break it down. I'm going to talk about it in your language.
Paraphrase, I think, is the word you're looking for.
I'm going to paraphrase, because you know what? Yeah. It turns out that every single fucking preacher in the history of mankind, that's what they do, too.
Yeah, paraphrase the Bible. I was just going to say, you just stepped down from God to priest now.
There you go.
Yeah, you just said, I know I disappointed you, but here's a recap of everything you need to know in my...
I'm going to do the priestly thing. I'm going to do the priestly thing. And
how very noble of you, Jacob.
Thank you. Yeah. But I'm going
to
be, here's the
good
thing.
Do I have
to
confess? Is there a booth in your bathroom?
There will be no confession. Here's the good news, though. I will not G-rate this shit. I think anybody who's listened to the shows realized that if it says in the Bible that Samson fucked Delilah, I'm going to fucking say it. That's just actually, I've been reading Samson because it's one of the future ones. He's a psycho. It's going to be a great episode.
He's so
fucking mental. It's going to be a great show. But on this show, what we're going to talk about, because the other special treat, the part two of this special treat, is that Chris shares a very intimate relationship with a or past relationship with a religion that we're all fascinated by. So that's Jehovah's Witness. So you're a former Jehovah's Witness. And I thought, I'm like, well, if you're going to soundtrack the show and we're going to be talking about what the fuck happened to you, who better to soundtrack the whatever harrowing tale of disaster we're about to uncover in this, the bonus show. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, do we have a jingle for that? Am I meant to make a jingle?
Fuck, man, that is your job, dude. Is there a jingle? Yeah. I don't know. Is there? Look, I know this is kind of weird, but you have to imagine.
You're just handing creative control to me now. Now you're like...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, it's already done. No, it happened before.
Now you're a peasant? You went from God to peasant in like 3 minutes?
No, it happened before. See, here's the thing you have to understand about the way that you make podcasts is that you have to pretend that you've already done what you say you're going to do.
So we got a jingle here, so let's...
You already had a jingle.
Say
that
again.
You don't even realize.
But
it already happened.
Just pause, wait. There's the jingle.
No. You don't even need to pause.
No.
There's no need to pause.
I just didn't want you interrupting the jingle.
I'm just going to say...
Are you going to...
Well, okay, you're editing this, so ultimately you can choose what you're going to choose.
Putting so much work on myself in the editing room
here. Well, fuck yeah, man. It's your responsibility. Brought to you by Chris Tenz, because, Chris, you're also a musician and whose music I quite enjoy, and we'll be working together on lots of cool stuff. So you guys are going to be able to preview that. Isn't that a little bit more exciting? I hope it makes up... For my...
His lack of audio quality, for one, I'm going to just...
Yeah, well, I'm sure you'll be able to compensate for that. But I really hate disappointing when I promise a Bible story. But the truth is, when I actually started reading on Noah, I realized that there's not enough material there to make a whole show. So I was actually going to round up the beginning of Genesis up to Noah. It's taken me a little bit more time to research. I want to put the love into it, you know. I really want to make it a good show.
You listeners realize how much work here Jacob puts into his research.
No.
Right?
They don't know. They're like, where's the show, man? And you're like, I torture over my shows.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize it. They're like, don't you just hit the record button?
Yeah, he has to drink cider because he's never tried good beer because he's too poor. I mean, we're talking about a man who who's devoted and sacrificed everything for this.
All right, let's talk about some tragedy here, because I suppose at the end of the day, it's the kind of thing that you expect from the situation. I want to start from the beginning. So you were born where exactly? So set for me the stage, what of your birth, the environment that I'm expected to empathize with. So what is it like?
This is exclusive. I mean, no one's ever wanted to hear this start to finish. So
everyone's going to want to hear this.
This is the first listen.
It's exclusive. Let's do it. All right, let's probe. I'm going to be Charlie
Rose
here. So
your question to me, can you make that more concise then?
So what I want to know is, you are to some degree a product of your environment, what the people who are there are like, the kind of culture that's around there. So you're the place of birth where you were, where is this?
I was born in Calgary, actually.
So you were born in Calgary, but is this where you were raised? Like, were you raised in sort of the outskirts?
The Calgary area. For the first few years, it was Calgary, and then in Airdrie, which is kind of, it's like a suburb that's 10 minutes away, basically, in a sense of the city limits. So it's the worst of everything.
you're connected, but you're still a bit far, so that it's a trip.
And you picture you growing up there, you know, like 10 years old, 11 years old or something, and it's, you don't have the means to get into Calgary, so you don't have the means to connect to a wider community than that one suburb. So it's like, take all of Tuscany and isolate it from the rest of the city. Right. You know, and then you're a kid, so you know, you don't have a car unless you steal a car, and that's only good for one night. There's no permanent solution to this disconnect, you know, it's kind of...
And the city is interpreted in this environment that you live in as what? As a sinful place? As a sort of like, is this an evil place?
That was the personal decision of my mom and my stepdad when my mother remarried. You know, I guess my stepdad and all his lack of worldliness, per se, living in Airdrie his entire life, except for 1 year that he spent in Calgary, was, you know, I think he was 28 years old when he married my mother and took on the responsibilities of being, you know, a stepfather. Had never lived outside of Airdrie and was still happened to be living in his parents' house, I think, when my mom married him. So he thought, well, I'm comfortable here in this little box, so let's... Kick it in here. Let's take a gamble and
take
a huge risk and educate ourselves and stay in the box.
Yeah, it sounds almost like it's, well, we found a spot and now it's time to dig in the trenches.
Yeah.
And so this is in the environment in which you're growing up, or you're born in this environment?
Like, I was born before my mother did get divorced.
Right.
So the first few years of my life were spent in, I guess it would be southeast Calgary. I think, the location by Forest Lawn. I think it was Aaron Woods. I think Aaron Woods was the community.
And your mother, by this point, was not a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, no, she was. My mother was a Jehovah's Witness, undercover from her family's knowledge by the age of 14.
Oh, really? So
yeah, her
family
was
alive.
Her family was, well, you know, various half-assed kind of religious family.
Okay.
You know, typical Christians. Not totally practicing, but we'll say
go to church.
A blessing before our meal, right. Kind of. And really, you know, essentially pretty open people. I guess she kind of came up in a kind of a farm family in a way, you know, living just out of the city in Ontario. But that's a whole other story. My mom, though, so desperate, her search at 14 years old, essentially, like her father was this alcoholic. You know, she witnessed a lot of corrupt morals in order to support that habit. Things like that in her family that traumatized her. Of course, 8 children all kind of took it out on each other. You know, didn't know how to deal with it. Living in a small town, well, just outside of a small town in Ontario. So at 14 years old, obviously was desperate for some moral compass.
Or maybe not just that. People to trust,
mm-hmm.
an environment of stability.
Exactly.
I mean, anything that a person that is in
is
in a chaotic environment is going to crave.
Yeah, there's a reason some kids join a gang at the age of 9.
Yeah. It's not the reason that you think it is. It's not just to be cool. It's that because for a lot of people, it's structure, it's direction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... for the most part, people are moral. They don't want to do things that are against their nature, but...
Let's face it. Uncertainty is really fucking scary.
Yeah,
You're a human being.
It's disturbing.
You slowly start piecing together your own experience and your own interpretation, but you question that. I mean, I think you and I were just talking about earlier how we still do this. We still question ourselves. We still are afraid of the uncertain to some extent.
Well, we,
so for a 14-year-old in that kind of family, that's terrifying, you know?
I wouldn't blame person. I mean, there weren't a lot of other alternatives, particularly at the time, I'm guessing. Right?
Yeah.
It's like, where else are you going to go? I have a choice. I can go to this cult. They're going to take care of me, and I can get away from this chaotic environment, have everything I want.
Yeah.
And I think that I remember...
Well, there's no promise or guarantee on the second option, you know? No one could say to you with certainty in their eyes that you'll get this if you do this. There's no... You know, in just abandoning it and just letting your own life evolve, you know, there's not a lot of reassurance there.
I think that, though, that even on a more pragmatic, practical, down to the individual that either chooses to kind of follow a cult-like mentality in order to benefit from all of the, you know, the other stabilizing aspects that religion offers, mm-hmm. and the other variant that say, I don't want this and I'm going to select something else, I think what you'd find is that, generally speaking, the alternative for a long time hasn't been available. There wasn't a lot of real choice out there. Mm-hmm. This is something that people are starting to realize and recognize, you know, why the atheism community exists. I mean, 7 years ago when I was really just talking about this in the beginning, where it's just all of this stuff was starting before I even did the blog, but it was just thinking about it. And everyone was saying, it's like herding cats, man. Who gives a shit? It's not worth it. And unbeknownst to me, there were people doing this kind of stuff even way before me, trying to build up this awareness. And what happens is that you fill a hole. You fill a need that's still present, even if we don't what do we share in common? Oh, I don't know. The idea that... God is just a ludicrous concept to try to make us feel better about our the fragility of our existence.
What do we have in common? We think critically, and it's a little frightening.
I just realized what it means.
And I feel kind of alone right now, and I need to be able to talk to this.
It's like, did you realize that you were fucking floating around in a giant ball of rock with a tiny fucking atmosphere around a nuclear fucking
oven?
And
you don't know how any of it got here.
What the hell's going on? And you just realize this. You're like, I am alive and I don't know what to do. And you freak out, right?
Yeah. Who am I going to talk to you about this? Yeah.
So obviously that need, the need exists. Yeah. What's cool about it is that that's being fulfilled. The trouble is it's still a little bit awkward, going about this. Because we fight against our nature to really organize to some degree, you know? Like, I think as atheists, we're afraid of labels, you know. We're afraid of being associated with groups, being like of religious people. They secretly get to us when they say, like, you're just like us. And
you know,
like,
we're scared
of
the idea that being agnostic or being an atheist is just another religion in itself. I think, you know, you don't, you're scared of creating that which you're, you know, against. I think to an extent, right?
Like, right. Well, and I think that the ability to overcome that. That sort of fear. And it's a natural thought to have because everyone should think about whether or not that's possible.
Well, isn't that a basic fear? I mean, think about that psychologically.
Oh, you have to.
You're afraid to take a stand because you know it's going to create social change for you, regardless. It just seems like really basic human fear, you know. You're afraid of isolation.
If you're so convinced that it's not possible.
Ostracism.
If you're so convinced that it's not possible, then I would say that is a dangerous mindset. And it's not because there's anything that is like religion in atheism at all, because obviously atheism is just a lack of belief. But the things that the hole that we fulfill in people's lives, the need for meaning, that itself is a different conversation. And now there's lots of people that where religion had offered that, now we offer, in a sense, an alternative, and to suddenly turn our fucking backs and say, well, I don't have any responsibility towards towards this whole thing. I just don't believe, and that doesn't matter. And you're like, are you fucking kidding? Look, even your own awareness of this has created an environment where people now need some fucking answers and some goddamn guidance. Mm-hmm. Because just when you're at that point where you're like, well, I don't believe that there's a God, you still need guidance. Yeah. I still get emails all the time from fans that are literally asking me for guidance, asking me, are you a nihilist? Someone was asking
you're
me, like,
are
you
honestly... drinking your cider? You're like, why is this in my inbox?
They're like, why me? I want you to be my guide. And all of a sudden you're just like, okay, listen, pal. And somebody asked me, are you a nihilist because of what you believe in? And you understand now that, look, this is just a reality of this emerging, I don't know what to call it, this emerging movement, right? Mm-hmm. Where we've separated ourselves so much from religion's tyranny on us that we kind of fail to recognize that there are lots of people out there that are very confused, they're very... they have absolutely no idea where to turn.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's lots of voices saying, like, we shouldn't do anything about it.
And that's why it's such a dangerous transition to be in, you know?
Makes yourself very vulnerable. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, a person who lets go of that.
And I like, that's.
You went,
that's why
you
I'm
went
here.
Through
that's
you went through that. Okay, so let's yeah. continue on with your story. So. When we last left off, we understood sort of,
quite a tangent there, but yeah, back to the story. Yeah.
Boy, everybody who listens to the show, at least the bonus show, realizes that I am a tangent man.
Yeah.
If you listen to the show, you're like, oh, please, yeah. Jacob, can you have some yeah. order about things? I'm like, get the fuck out of here. You don't know how this shit works.
I've just learned now.
I need to
keep notes as I talk to you to get back to points or that I meant to
normally
ask,
normally I keep studious notes yeah. about everything. Yeah. I'm a lot better, but you're a bit of a surprise guest, and considering how busy you are, it just worked out, and we had talked so many times about your experience, so that's why I want to go back to it. So
okay.
So your mother now finds comfort in this new organization.
Yeah, she met a girl at school. This okay. one girl there, you know, like, oh, what are you reading? Oh, well,
hello.
Let me tell you. Yeah, and there goes, yeah, that you don't ask a Jehovah's Witness what they're reading. You just, there's a reason they're out there. I got training on this as a kid. You purposely, that's your conversation opener. You sit in a coffee shop, and no, you don't pull out that BMX magazine you want to read because you're 14 and you're in a suit and you feel kind of awkward. So yeah, you pull out the Watchtower, you sit there, you open it up. Oh, some interesting article about why does God permit suffering? And so it's, I've wondered that, you know? Like, if there is this God, why does he... Natural question. Makes sense. Yeah, what are you reading? Yeah, there goes my mom.
The
14
trap.
Years old. You know, this community that gave her their version and interpretation of what love and acceptance and welcoming is. And, you know, that's... I think the biggest thing is... that's why it's such a slippery slope. I mean, when that's everything you wanted, I mean, I've fallen into it in relationships. How many, you know, girls have you been with that presented themselves as what you wanted in order to...
luckily not too many,
but it happens, you know.
It does happen.
we all fall for the thing we want most that's presented to us by someone with an ulterior motive, I think. And that's the scary part about the organization for me now. You know, it's not so much a right and wrong as much as how it caters to human fear so readily. So yeah, my mother in her most vulnerable moments of being a teenager, confused and like clearly facing moral dilemmas that nobody else was acknowledging. You know, she felt isolated, and suddenly this basic morality of, oh yeah, you don't become an alcoholic and beat your wife in front of your kids. You know, suddenly that, oh, someone gets me.
Well, I respond to that. Here's my own experience, although this is just a tiny... Here's another tangent. But I identify with that because I remember when I came back from DR, I was in a bad way. You know, me and Chris were limited resources, and we had to stay in a very small room, you know, just... On a really uncomfortable futon, that kind of stuff, just because, the the difficulty of finding a place in Calgary. You know how it is.
Yeah.
You know how it is around here.
Yeah.
And when we were able to upgrade, you know, once we were able to get a room, even though the room itself wasn't a huge room. In fact, it was quite small considering like our needs.
I think
once we were able
to. Was
that
the room I just slept in the other night?
Yeah, that was that room. That was that room.
It's like barely enough room for,
there's not a lot of room.
Side by side
with an office and that kind of stuff, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when you think about it, was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot imagine. It felt like paradise. And it worked. And it was really good for like a whole month because it was just, you were used to the horrors of before.
Yeah.
But that's really, what you don't realize is when you've accustomed yourself to the horror, anything seems better. And that's always the trap that people fall. That's why religions sort of like pick up everybody else. But trust me when I say like the people looking for answers, they are out there. If you don't snatch them up and at least point them in the right direction, and that does involve some tutelage, that involves all of us getting involved. Like, I put up a letter a couple of weeks ago from a fan who was like, I'm thinking about whether or not I should go to university, and they were offering me a religious scholarship to do so. Now, I offered him a kind of two-piece advice. I said, number one, student debt has now surpassed credit card debt in North America. It is now at $1 trillion. That is how much people owe in student debt. Okay? Think about that when you're just like wondering, like, what am I going to do? Like, that's a huge part of it. Debt is a reality of now sort of participating in sort of, I guess, what it is, the system, right?
Mm.
If you want to sort of like go that route, be aware it is a contract for debt. And now if somebody's enticing you with a grant, allowing you to reduce that, you're kind of like forced between two leashes, right? You're like, well, this religion will force...
What are the stipulations of that?
Yeah,
did
what
you
are the
go
stipulations
into detail in this
Well,
letter?
Actually, that was the great thing about it. So that during the conversation, I put that up. Other members, people that listen to the show or go to the site, commented themselves and gave various advice. Because I'm like, I don't want to give the advice. I think that you should listen to lots of people's different opinions and then choose the one that you think is the most reasonable.
Yeah.
Because I can't have any good advice for anybody that decides that they're going to go through I hate to sound like one of these people, but go through the system, right? To go through the normal rigmarole of like, I am going to go to school, get a degree, then I'm going to get a job,
pay off that debt,
and then I'm going to buy a house, have a family, and that kind of stuff.
You
I don't subscribe
can't
to that
Can't take
life.
A 40-year mortgage, bad. Got to take a 20-year. Yeah.
Right. If you're...
Yeah. Imagine being that in a completely religious environment. Yeah. Terrifying.
That's scary.
Married at 21, looking at
Let's go back. I want to work chronologically here. This is your show because ultimately you're editing, not me.
Fantastic.
It will have your.
I feel like this should be quite unedited, to be honest. But
I normally don't do too much except recently because whenever you're doing stuff over Skype. There's long pauses and stuff like that. Sometimes you're interrupting one another.
But from what I understand of you, you try to make these as raw and honest as possible.
Oh,
this is I have nothing in front of me other than the things that Jacob used to inebriate me, and here I am spilling out my darkest secrets.
Well, that's usually the way to do it.
Yeah, makes sense. So yeah, just for the listeners, I don't think I've ever told this entire story in detail. People know bits and pieces of what I went through, and I was confronting the fear that was kind of addressed earlier of the responsibility that comes with sharing my experience and choosing the paths that I've done. Something I've always been skeptical to discuss. I mean, I know there's a lot of forums and resources for ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. There's, people have written books. I didn't want to jump into that because I wasn't running away from a religion or oppression. I was running away from the idea of ego leading you to believe you have an answer to something that someone else doesn't.
I know, but I do want to warn you as an individual that there are the chances that someone could be influenced by your words that are about to be uttered through your story.
Yeah.
Will have repercussions. I can promise you that.
And that's what's it's only because I'm starting to understand what it's like to be somewhat self-confident this year.
that I'm the year of self-confidence. Yeah, that what I'm, an enjoyable year.
That I'm going about actually doing this. So there's I've told stories in other ways. My first album told the story, which I've never told anyone in detail, of the year and a half I went through of just personal doubt and questioning based on, you know, the moral implications of how people were treating one another in the organization.
Well, the
so,
thing is...
So, but it was totally instrumental. Yeah. I didn't utter a word. The album's divided by chapters. It was a way of me processing the pressures of that year and a half. It wasn't significant. I didn't leave then, but I was still caught up in it, and right. I had all these personal doubts, and that's a really isolating thing, you know?
Well, I think that... There is something to be said about the liberation of making your own life public, because I won't deny the fact that my life is very public. Mm-hmm. You know, I was wondering the other day, I'm like, there are people out there that know I feel almost at times too much about me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I look at the list of your shows already and your episodes, and you're not smart enough to make up that much fiction. Like, I see that you've
really... I drop on reality. Of course I
do. You have to. It's the easiest... I mean, I see how you inspire yourself. It's the easiest. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Write what you know. So your mother has joined this cult,
mm-hmm.
She has, in the process, does she move to Ardry? Is this where she is?
No, that's a hell of a jump. That's skipping a lot of story.
Okay, well, try.
She grew up in rural Ontario, okay, right. And that's where she discovered this. She snuck around from ages 14 to 16. Her 16th birthday gift was that she was allowed to be a Jehovah's Witness. That was her mother's, I'm going to trust you, after 2 years of a lot of family fighting over this, her mother said, I'll allow it. Basically, her mother saying, I'll support it. And this is...
The worst mistake that she ever made.
No. It's funny. Like, recalling this again, I haven't gone into this detail for a while, but this, I just illuminated a very important thing that makes my mother the biggest hypocrite I know. It's because when I said, I don't want to be a witness, she disowned me. But her 16th birthday gift from her mother, a Catholic... was I will allow you to be baptized and dedicated as a Jehovah's Witness.
Wow.
Officially, there's paperwork, I'm sure, in some big office.
And have they talked since?
Mm-hmm. Yep. My grandma has always supported my mother. She's always there for her. She finds ways, you know. She sends out a Christmas parcel to all her other kids. But...
She manages to make that work.
She makes that work because you don't celebrate Christmas. So she waits a couple months and then collects what she called, I remember this as kids... a care package, and sends out all her gifts to her, you know, her daughter and grandkids, us,
right.
who we weren't allowed to be terribly close to, because she was considered a threat to our faith. This woman who went out of her way.
who brought care packages
in February instead of December 25th, just to respect the beliefs, because she still found a way around it, and... She didn't intrude. She didn't stick her nose in. Wow. She just catered to my mom. And I remember when she would come out for visits from Ontario to Airdrie, you know, how she would always respect. She would let my stepdad, this really emotionally immature 28-year-old man that married my mom, like, let him say the family blessing in his way, you know? Like, she always surrendered that. She didn't want to force it. She just wanted her daughter to be happy.
Man.
You know, and supported her regardless and went out of her way. I mean, she's not wealthy, but making a giant parcel for 8 different kids and their kids every year, she worked her ass off as a grandma.
Man.
You know?
So, okay. Well,
yeah. I mean, thanks, Mom. I just realized how much of a hypocrite she is.
I love you, Mom. Yeah. Okay, so she is... So
my mom's a zealot. We'll go back to the story. She's 16. She's devoted. She's dedicated.
Yeah.
By the time she graduated from high school, I think she was, 17 or 18. You know, she was an intense witness, very, very active. There was a ban on Jehovah's Witnesses in Quebec until my mother was about 17 or 18. you know, they weren't allowed to, you know, preach, basically. So they had to find ways around that. I mean, there was a thriving community of witnesses literally risking their lives. And this happens in a lot of countries, meeting in underground groups and everything. And, I mean, I get it. Breaking the rules is desirable. It's kind of
but it's really sweet when you do.
Yeah, it's got to be fun. Awesome. When you're meeting in some basement and, you know, you got to follow the... Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. It would have been fun. You get to play out all the movies at this time. I think it was this, I don't know. But yeah, my mom was, you know, 17, 18, and they suddenly this ban was lifted. The political powers that be decided to allow Jehovah's Witnesses to congregate.
Do you have no idea how that happened, though?
Right? Oh, like, by the witnesses literally, like, recruiting lawyers and... It's a very elaborate process, but there's an entire legal department of Jehovah's Witnesses to deal with issues like that, or blood transfusions, or... So well done. It's a well-oiled machine, my friend. It is well-oiled. It is the best.
It's systematic.
Should see the printing presses. It's unreal. So it's very systematic, and so the ban was lifted in Quebec, and so there was this need, according to them, this great need... And this is what they would call at the time, to serve where the need is greater. My mom uprooted her life in Ontario, left her, you know, family of, you know, poverty and alcoholism and people that didn't like the fact that she was a witness, I guess, and served where the need was greater. Essentially, she went to join a mass exodus of people from every other province to Quebec to go preach full-time, become what's called pioneers. At the time, that meant you had to spend 90 hours a month preaching on your dime and your time, your resources. So she did this, and it was during that mass preaching campaign in Quebec that she met my father, my biological father. So my father was raised a witness. By that point, already was having his doubts, didn't quite believe in it, but went along with it because the option was social suicide. Charmed my mother. They got married pretty young. They moved to Calgary. So that's...
an odd decision after their whole exodus to Quebec, but mm-hmm. So are you the oldest of your
the youngest of my family? Okay. Yeah.
And in the environment where you grew up, so mm-hmm. There's what, three kids? You're the youngest.
Two.
There's two kids.
Two, yeah, it's just me and my brother.
You and your brother. Okay, so in this environment, two kids, and you're how old? What's the difference in age between you and your brother?
3 years.
3 years. So yeah, it's still relatively close, but not super, super close.
Yeah.
And this household that you're growing up in, they are very involved in the church.
That's the thing. I mean, that's conservative household. That's where there was a lot of ammo to convince me that being a witness was a good idea. And this is where, you know, I had to face a lot of philosophical and ethical problems and moral problems. Was the first few years of my life was hell for my parents. You know, my father rebelled and turned to drinking, lying, manipulating, you know, straight away. By the time he had kids, he was already getting drunk, lying, saying he was at work every night with his buddies at work. You know, literally a very respected witness at the time who was a ministerial servant, one bar under elder in the hierarchy,
right.
Unless they've changed that since. I mean, they've every couple of years.
Okay.
But, yeah, so he was well respected. He was a figure. He was giving a lot of, you know, speeches. They're called talks, I guess. There's so much lingo, it's really hard to try to translate that. So, I mean, you know, this is a guy who's up on the platform at a congregation meeting or an assembly, anywhere between an audience of 100 to 1,000 people, telling them how to live their lives, already drunk, because he said he was late for work drinking that night. He was living a complete double life. So that allowed for a lot of bitterness and resentment and ego and arrogance to brew. So my father left my mother. I was 5 years old. I think when they pulled me and my older brother downstairs, my father brought us down and told us, this is it, this is done. Getting the fuck out. And really, really did. As soon as my mom got remarried, it was the opportunity for him to basically, very selfishly, give us up for adoption. So here's this, you know, this is what my mother used our whole upbringing, is how this man you know, starts this family, marries someone, has kids, claims to be this person, then literally disowns and abandons all of his familial responsibilities and drinks his whole life away, and he's useless, and he was so unhappy, you know, but he convinced himself, you know, he's very happy, and, like, I'm...
So what he did was he represented all the things that church people tell you happens when you abandon religion.
Exactly.
He did all those things.
Embodiment. And I still, to this day, until we reconnected and until he actually listened to something I had to say about a year ago this time, I still have no respect for the decisions he made.
But do you know what that is? He knows that. Here's the trick of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Is they tell you what the life outside religion is, but
and
actually,
they give you the worst picture.
What that picture is a symptom of religion.
Exactly.
These are the side effects.
Yeah.
So they predict be like, oh well, when you leave, this happens. It's like,
yeah,
no.
Of course, because you're pissed off, you're oppressed, you're isolated, and you're desperate.
These are symptoms.
Yeah.
These are the symptoms. So the hilarious thing about it is they make you fearful of leaving.
Yeah. But they make you so scared to leave.
My father,
that's why I don't respect him, is because he created that stereotype. He gave my mother the ammo to be more paranoid. So he left a woman that stressed him out because she was paranoid and put a lot of impositions on him. He led a double life and lied to her. Then he got to the point where he had a raging temper. And then decided to just leave. Lie, say he had had an affair so he could become disfellowshipped and excommunicated and divorced. Left her with the kids. When my mom got remarried 2 years later, gave us up for adoption because there was some legal struggle. There was some legal battles. You know, so he, in a sense, in angrily rejecting everything he did, he created a stereotype which made the first, you know, 15 years of my life the most confusing and the most...
But it can't be easy. It can't be easy to break into. But honestly, Chris, it can't be easy to try to break into that. I mean, like, to be the devil's advocate here. I mean, a person who suffers the symptoms of religion, mm-hmm. who chooses to do what most people do,
mm-hmm.
Is only guilty of really being human, of not being able
to
be
affected by the... And that's why I'm not...
Irrationality of religion.
I'm not angry at him, but he exasperated the problem he was trying to resolve in that sense. And that's what's scary about the religion.
So you're disappointed rather than angry.
No, I'm disappointed in the effects of religion. I realize it's all symptomatic.
Right.
I'm not angry at him. I'm angry at how... He was affected. I think of what he was facing back then, and I understand. I really do. But he made the problem worse, and that's where...
So you believed that there were reasons for you to continue to believe, because the portrait that they offered you so clearly...
They used him as the extreme example, right. You know, and he just handed it to them on a platter.
And I'm sure there was a lot of resentment on your part too, of saying, like, they fed on that resentment, of saying, mm-hmm. like, here he's abandoned you.
And that's exactly it.
I'm like, these abandonment issues, you know, would
you
just
take
make
a
you
5-year old kid and you feed him, like, it's like feeding a kid pure candy because it's so tasty because it's craving sugar because you fed him candy yesterday. It's so evil.
It's so twisted.
You know, so growing up, that's labeled an apostate. Someone who's angry and tries to turn people away is labeled an apostate. What I'm doing
is apostasy.
Right now is apostasy.
In fact, you're encouraging apostasy, so you're...
Right now. So I'm the worst of the worst.
Oh, yeah.
Just by telling you what I went through.
What does that make me, then?
You weren't a witness before. You're just an atheist. That's almost as scary as an apostate. That's level 2.
You're scarier than me.
Yeah. Basically, I'm more of a threat than you are because I'm scared to talk about what I went through, I think. I don't know. Why am I scary? So. Am I that intimidating? Because
I
remember meeting you and being like, I'm not intelligent enough to talk to this guy. I'm just...
Don't say these things.
No?
You have to be very careful because if you start saying that I'm super smart on the show, everyone's going to be like...
Building up, now.
Yeah.
Now you're going to have to smoke twice as much of the reefer to keep up with the expectation I just imposed.
No, not even then. People are going to be like, oh, he's so egotistical, blah, blah. I'm just like, please...
What a dick.
Don't be too nice. Honestly, it ends up hurting me in the end. Even people treat me less well if I'm treated nicely by my guests. So you were encouraged to treat me like a piece of shit on the show.
Wow.
Very encouraging. And you must, if you think that any of my opinions are absolutely retarded, you must speak doubly loud about it. It's very important, because I could charismatically convince you that everything that comes out of my mouth is the truth when it is fact. Well, yeah, bullshit.
I mean, that's, but so can I. I mean, I grew up learning how to do that. All right,
that's fair. So what you're saying is, you have a bullshit detector. I haven't set it off so far. Okay, good. So we're in the clear. So let's go back to your history. So they use this resentment regarding your father to try to fuel this, and I'm supposing that.
Exactly, and my mother really.
To be the devil's advocate, I will say that he is, you know, the part of him, what his quote unquote redemption could have been like, he could have handled that better.
Yes,
it's the recognition.
It's just like he had a really difficult situation, and he had an opportunity to handle it better. He kind of failed there, but that doesn't take away the fact that the situation he was facing was monumental.
It's still dire. It's still dire.
I told him with tears in my eyes when I reconnected with him 3 years ago. Right. I get it.
It's not easy.
I know it's not easy, but if I could do better than that when I left, I know he could have because I'm not that special.
Well, you know what?
And that's
the truth is though that you are still in a different environment. Something.
But I am. Yeah. I never had. You know, when I left my wife, there was no kids in the picture. There was no.
Not just that, but the society that you live in now. I mean, like Canada is not as religious as it used to be. It's actually the degradation of religion in Canada is actually happening really, really fucking fast. Mm. It's actually surprising people. Like, they're scared about it. I think there's something like 2064, there will be no religion anymore in Canada if the trends continue. And they're conservative trends,
which,
by
the way, is Jehovah's Witnesses' prediction of the beginning of the apocalyptic times, is when the government say no more religion. That's known as the Great Tribulation. That's our sign that we have to be extra faithful. Okay. That's when we have to break the laws and do it all undercover. Yeah.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
Isn't that amazing? Like, just taking basic...
The enemy within, yay!
Such intuitive observation. Yeah, religion's going to die out. Obviously. Obviously.
They're well aware of that. Every religion has been aware of that to some degree. You don't think the Zoroastrians were like, I think we're having a serious decline, because they used to be the shit.
Yeah, like, we were quite popular 2,000 years ago.
What happened? I don't know, man. Yeah. What happened was that the nothing got fulfilled. Zoroaster made a prediction, nothing happened. People waited about 2,000 years, got a little bit bored, and then were like, we're gone. So, have you heard this fucking story before? I'm like, mm-hmm. And pretty soon, I'll tell you what, you know what's my favorite brand of car? Mazda. Do you know why? Because that's an ancient god. Uhura Mazda is the god of Zoroastrianism. So when you're driving a car in the future, you may drive a 2064 Jesus. You know what I mean? It's like some of I want to make sure that that everybody understands is the fact that what I'm hopeful for, I know that there's a lot of people that listen, specifically really young kids that are probably, you know, in situations that sound really very much like your own, you know, where they have to make a choice very soon. At some point, you're like
I picture myself a few years ago and.
You know where you are, because it's a gradual decision, right? It's not like you're going to fucking make this decision overnight. How can you? It is not a fucking trivial decision to make.
And I knew that intuitively, and that's...
You understood.
That's where in some senses, I am proud of myself and the fact of how I approached that, because most people turn to something really reckless or really dangerous in order to, you know, satisfy that needs to get out or separate themselves, and how I handled that was literally a five-year decision. And when I talked about my first album before, and I said how I place clips, which I'll do in the editing phase, is to give you guys an idea of how I try to communicate what that feels like through sound and through mood. And that's what my first album was based on. Nobody knows that. My label that released it doesn't even know that. Because I just put it as Forlorn Memories was the title of the album, Chapter 1, Chapter 2, Chapter 3. Because I didn't just want to give that to people. I wanted them to be able to, you know, apply it to themselves meaningfully in their own stories. All that anyone knew was that it was a year and a half of my life, but I kind of now I'm inspired to really explain what that was about. It was about a year and a half of my life where nothing really big happened. I was just facing all these doubts. It was all this internal thought. It's not a really significant year other than my own gradual awakening into what I needed to do and what my path was. it's not when I left. It took me another couple of years to actually pursue making music. And that's when I conceived of this album. You know, it took a while before I finally just closed all doors in that regard, when I fully stepped out of that organization. You know, but I only did so because I thought about it for years.
Well, courage does not grow overnight. Mm-hmm. All right, let's be truthful. I mean,
it was terrifying. If you're a witness, you're thinking, what if this is wrong? You're immediately scared because that thought, you know, could lead you away. How everyone in your life would reject you.
Not only that, how are you supposed to be anointed if you had any doubt whatsoever? There's only 144,000. That's not a lot. There's
but
like
it's not just
people.
That. I mean, the other option for the rest of the population is eternal happy life on a paradise earth. Will you never will suffer and never die and never get sick and never get old? But it's not that. And it never was that for me. I wasn't that attached to life. I remember being so fed up at age 11, I wanted to suffocate myself, you know, I wasn't, death didn't scare me, but you know everyone in your life is going to reject you, you're going to be ostracized, if you even vocalize, I'm having doubts about this, suddenly you're perceived differently, you're perceived as a danger and a threat to your own family, to your best friends, being a kid, being a teenager, growing up, never knowing anyone outside of that environment, that is a terrifying prospect.
I suppose that for us, this is the price that we paid as organisms, that we live, we are advanced enough as thinking beings that the decisions that we make ideologically can overcome the biological urges and instincts that we have. So the biological instinct to love your family, to stand by them, to provide support, can be overridden with just an idea. And this is like that kind of weird... I mentioned last time that Faustian bargain with our own intelligence, where what a terrifying prospect it is when you think about the fact that you could just believe, or someone that you love could just believe in something that would separate them forever from you because the idea itself makes you the enemy. And this, I feel at the core of any idea, is the indication that something is wrong with your idea. Now, when a person says, isn't atheism similar? Aren't you declaring that there is no God and therefore creating, like, you know, strife, conflict by that idea? Mm-hmm. And I would say that my non-idea of God is itself just a rejection of an idea. The idea itself, the one of God, that's the problem. It's this notion that can take over that biological or, you know,
Or moral urges that we have, destroy morals in the name of creating them. What? That's the worst deception I could think of. Think about that.
Yeah.
You can literally tear apart a moral or an ethic in the name of being more moral. And you could convince someone that's what you did and why. And even more scary is the fact that you could convince yourself.
Well, ideas are dangerous specifically because they work, they're effective. And, you know, when you think about how many people are Jehovah's Witnesses, when they have a memorial thing and they're like, you know, 18 million
people. Yeah, it goes from 7 million to 18 million, yeah.
You just realize the scope of just the ignorance. That's huge.
That's over double the amount, you know, almost triple the amount that are interested in possibly becoming a Jehovah's Witness. That comes to that. I mean, that's, you know, as a kid, I grew up handing out memorial invitations. It was this big annual thing. It was the only real holiday we celebrated, the memorial of Christ's death. And it wasn't an Easter egg hunt. It was sitting down, passing bread and wine in a formal setting after multiple prayers and multiple songs. And we literally invited everyone on the street to this, you know, offering. And it's just, it seems like such exploitation because a lot of those people could be people who are desperate for any sense of hope or any sense of certainty. It's worse than a life insurance agency. At least you get something back from a life insurance policy, you know? Like,
this is something that I think every non-believer has to grasp with. The people that are like, this is herding sheep, we can't do anything about this, is the realization that if you don't, they will. That's exactly. Just how it is. Yeah. That's just how it is. You got to fucking play by their game. It's not like, oh, I'm going to sit back. I'm going to be the bigger person. Congratulations. I bet the people in Carthage, you know, back when the Roman Empire were wiping them out, I bet they thought they were morally superior. It doesn't fucking matter. It's like, who is left standing at the end of the day? Unless you take any kind of action, unless you do something about it, if you just stand by, you're just... I'm not saying you're part of the problem, but... let's just say that this is not the place to be.
Yeah,
okay?
You're not helping them.
You're not helping.
Yeah.
Like, you have an option here. You can help or you cannot help. I don't suggest not helping.
There's no in between. There's no middle ground. Because if you refuse to help, you're not helping. It's one or the other.
But it's
someone drops their change on the street, you're either an asshole or you're helping. Right? Like, there's no standing there pretending you're not there standing looking at it.
You had the opportunity to do something right. And that, let me tell you something, isn't something that's always easy. I put up a video on the site. Please, everybody that's listening to this, go to the site and watch it. It's like We're Only Human, and that's the title, I think, of the article. But it's a video. It's one of those things where it's like a TV show where they filmed a fake scene where a woman was speaking against like a homosexual couple, and then they were just trying to see how people would behave. And there was this one guy in the video, I forget what minute it is, minute three or four, and he writes a letter to the woman that he thinks has been being berated, this lesbian couple. Like, he writes this letter, and I dare anyone to watch that that thing just to hear the letter and not have to fight back some kind of fucking tear. And the fact, and for me, like, the realization that, I mean, it's fairly universal. Most people watch it, they're like, yeah, okay, got to me to some degree. And noticing that happens, for me, that's actually the most touching thing about being human. Mm-hmm. The fact that I can feel...
Empathy.
Yeah, that I can empathize, that
which
I can
is,
feel the
which
feelings
is why
of
I was
other
so,
people.
Which is why I was so drawn to music. Which is why I was so drawn to creating sound, is because I have no idea. I mean, obviously, you know, I don't have the most supportive family in the world because I decided to, you know, turn my back on religion. So I don't have formal training, but I'm somehow intuitively really drawn to the process of being able to communicate on different levels and more empathetic levels. And I think music could do that. You know, a wordless song could literally transmit a feeling you go through to someone else's mind. It helps them relate. And that's happened to me so many times listening to music. And so I feel like I need to give back. You know?
I honestly, too, what I want people to understand when they're listening to the soundtrack that I'm predicting in the future that's happening as I'm talking, which I can't hear, but I'm assuming is good, that you are admittedly self-taught, that this is all just your work of pursuing your interest in music. So anybody who listens to anything that's going on, I mean, like, there's nobody else who's just producing. This is all Chris, okay, this is all his music, this is all his stuff, so don't assume, like, this is weird, because whenever I put up a comic, honestly, everyone's like, who draws your comics? Or, hey, who made your website? And you're like, no, I did all of that.
You don't get
people,
it, yeah.
Yeah, people
when
don't
I make
understand.
It out, people are like, oh, who mastered it? It's like,
exactly,
well,
right. Yeah. So that's what I want everyone to understand, because there is, I swear to you, like, as you talk, I imagine that there's a kid, some fucking Jehovah Witness kid who's just in this, trying to make the same difficult choice that you're talking about, having made, and realizing what the consequences of that are, but also seeing that there's a lot to be hopeful of. Like, part of what I hope that people will see, because I do find that you are talented, your music is good. I hope that people can sort of like see that there really is more to the suffocating pressures of life that they feel now.
Yeah,
the reason why they might be listening to this right now.
If anyone listening to this will forgive the conceit, admittedly, my biggest inspiration in pursuing music and essentially everything I do, it's always this thought in the back of my mind with all my choices, is how I could set an example to give someone else the courage to do something that I did. And that does not mean I was courageous. I just understand how difficult that is.
There's a base level of it. Like, don't undermine what you're trying to accomplish. Like, look, if I honestly, like, I am, you know, admittedly a mom's boy. I mean, I love my family very much. If I had to have any sort of, if anything really happened where I had to make a choice where I couldn't see him anymore, like, it would be, that choice itself would be devastating to me.
Your family and your closest friends. I mean, when you know you're making a choice, you know you morally have to make the choice, but you know every single person that you love and hold close to you, especially growing up as a witness, will inherently reject you by default, and that there's no exceptions to that rule because that's their reality and that's their perception. It's, you know, I picture, like, jumping off a cliff or a building as a really easy choice now. It's just, it's not, you know, I guess it comes back to some of the cliche wisdom is, you know, it takes losing everything to appreciate something or, you know, things like that. And I don't want to sound super cliche because that's, I think those quotes are to make it seem less scary. It's terrifying.
It's terrifying,
it's
but
absolutely it's, terrifying.
It's terrifying until you realize a couple key things. Like, yeah. The number one, I think, key thing that everybody who's in that position has to realize is that the world outside of where you live in, the individuals that populate this planet mm-hmm. are surprisingly caring and loving. It would blow your mind.
And it's insane. It would really blow. As a witness, I was, you know, insane. I was raised to believe that if you're, yeah, sure, you're going to meet some nice, okay, and this is, I mean, I was talking to you earlier, you know, those who don't believe within the religion are called, and I quote, worldly people, you know, and I remember having a laugh with you over that, how that's such a compliment.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, someone's educated
you.
Themselves, and,
oh,
and
they're worldly, don't pay attention to them.
Scared of being called worldly, and then I remember as I got out and really thought about what that meant, I realized I actually aspired to be worldly, and that was that's why I was so conflicted all those years.
They made it seem so horrible.
You know, they make it seem like any, you know, worldly person, essentially anyone who doesn't believe in, and again I quote, the truth, will essentially never love you in the true human sense. It's the idea is, if you don't believe in this faith, that you're so corrupt and tainted by the world that you can't possibly care about someone enough to put their needs before your own, ever. It's just, yeah, you're
that's
nice.
Impossible.
You're nice, but you smoke a cigarette from time to time, so you can't really embody love because you're hurting yourself, right? Like, and so it's
so twisted.
It's so bad.
Oh, and, my goodness.
You know, but you could give me a meal when I'm hungry, but that's just a way to lure me into your...
It's a tactic.
It's a tactic, you know? There's never any purity of heart.
Well, I didn't want to give it away, but yeah. I am expecting you to eat a baby any fucking moment.
Any minute, yeah. I'm going to be drinking the blood of a sacrificed goat.
Well, you have to.
Obviously.
Because otherwise the boils in your face will continue to grow. This
exactly.
is blood libel
yeah,
here.
It's, yeah.
I need the blood of Christian
you
babies.
I mean, that's the amount of times you've taken advantage of my trust in you, Jacob.
Well,
Because
it has
you know.
Been numerous. It has been numerous. Okay, so let's go back to where we left off. It's a bad chronology, but whatever. It's your show, man. You deal with it. So now you have that resentment. You're expressing, I guess, some like doubts. You said in your when it started 16. You said when you started to really start to come into these things. Like you said, it's a 5-year process. When did it start?
I guess I rounded out, but it's such a gradual thing. I mean,
try to think about the first real thought that stuck with you and saying like,
okay,
"This is some
bullshit."
It's
actually there was. I remember being like, I mean, I could never express it to my family or anyone in my
immediate
circle at all. And so in turn, it was extremely isolating. But I remember, I mean, it really does go way back when I really, no one knows
back,
this.
Back in time, man.
No
like,
one,
step into the time
no
machine.
No one's ever heard this. I mean,
step into the
you're
time
the first
machine,
person
go.
To hear this.
Awesome. Exclusive.
So exclusive. You better give us some money for this.
These are the patrons.
You're already paying. Okay, you get the exclusive.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your support, and here's your
report. Wait, unless they're the ones that don't pay for free, then
subscribers.
Fuck you, man. Well,
yeah.
Fuck, no, I'm just
assholes, making me sit here.
Don't say that.
Making me sit here and be cathartic and heal myself by talking about my experiences.
You jerks.
Yeah,
ass munchers.
So, such worldly people that listen to your show, Jacob.
You would be surprised, actually. You would be really, you would
okay.
be wonderfully
no, no, no.
surprised.
Tangent. Back, to, the, back
yeah.
to the start. Back
okay.
to the start. Okay,
here we go.
Okay, I really, I mean, honestly, thinking about when you start getting doubts, it's my earliest memories, you know, in a sense, you're told that there's this God, and you're part of this exclusive minority who knows exactly why he made you, where he comes from,
right.
The fact that he's, you know, these things, and then whenever there's a question, like, well, then when was he born? Well, time didn't exist. He invented time, Jacob, obviously. So you gotta be faithful. Whoa! 11 years old, and I'm so analytical. I mean, I didn't smoke weed till I was 21, but that was the biggest trip of my life, sitting with a friend who also had these doubts, and my mother's eventually, you know, she eventually decided I couldn't hang out with this friend because we had such critical conversations as 11 years old. And thinking, well, but how do you get around that? How do you get around this chicken or the egg dilemma where God always existed, always will exist? Time doesn't mean anything. He invented time for us because that's our limited comprehension. So we better believe in him because time exists.
He can stop time.
Yeah, think about that. You're 11 years old with your really weird, eccentric friend, and your mom thinks he's gay because you have a really good, close friendship, you know, so you're not allowed to hang out with them anymore. I remember being 13 or something when I was banned from going over to my neighbor's house, who was also, you know, raised as a witness.
What's he doing now, do you know?
Actually, he found me, he tracked me down. He's this really, like, computer nerdy dude with long hair who, like, you know, has explored a lot in life and really socially awkward and shy. You know,
I know the type.
He's autistic.
Many listen and to the show. Yeah. Very uncomfortable people who somebody will be like, I can't
probably
communicate
to this
with
day, the smartest kid I ever knew. I mean, yeah. I'm talking like 13, 14 years ago when computers were still kind of novel. He was building websites with HTML and he taught himself. He was 11 years old. He was designing video games, playable video games, and
but that sounds like what I was
as
doing
as an 11-year-old, and like nerdy and eccentric and passionate, and he was an artist, you know, and he is to this day, you know, and he my really weird eccentric sense of humor, I could really credit him to drawing it out in me, because I remember being 11, 12, these really weird imaginative tangents where you're sober and you're just genuine and you're just being silly and no one got it. I mean, it was such a, we were so weird. So, you know, witnesses who were like, no, like you can't,
such
you can't
a,
do
you
that.
Know, you know what it is?
Divided
it's such a rare,
us.
It's such a rare, it's such a rare age too. You're at a point where even in the friendships that you grow into as an adult, there is always that compulsion to keep things back because
exactly.
you have to some degree. It's not like it was in the ages of innocence, you know, where your whole life you could just be like, my whole life is I love bugs and blah, blah. During that time, you can be as much of quote-unquote yourself as you could ever possibly desire.
And that was really emerging. I mean, you know, when I befriended this kid and I was 11 years old, he lived next door to us. Like, that's when I discovered Monty Python's Flying Circus. That's when, we were talking about this earlier, when I really resonated with my misplaced heritage.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, I really, like, understood. I was sitting there, like, 11 years old, like, patiently dissecting their humor and, like, understanding it, like what they were getting at, you know. I'm like, everyone thinks they're just being silly and stupid, but no, like I could see how they reference this politically to this, and like getting, you know, terminology from British politics from the late 60s because I sat there and paid attention, but it was too weird. Or there was an episode where they show nudity in an effort to mock, you know, porno hungry classes of their era. And my father was just like, oh my God, no, you're not allowed to watch that ever again, you know. Or my friend Keenan, we would just be in hysterics, laughing all night, just talking, listening to music. You're not allowed to hang out with him anymore because you missed church the next day. You know, I mean, we're talking the bloomings of the Chris Ten's mind that is finally coming to you now on this recording.
Began with a simple friendship with a man who expanded your mind.
Literally, and he was also a young, raised as a witness person, and you know, he was just too eccentric. He was just too much of an individual to fit into that, and that really started showing. And so I was, you know, growing up for that point. I mean, I've never been younger than that. Like, just in a lot of emotional pain, trying to process what had happened in my family. You know, how I got to this point, begging, you know, this God, Jehovah, to give me some kind of sign, anything. You know, I remember, like, literally being, as a kid, in tears, being like, make something fall off my desk. Just something to show that you're hearing me, because that's all that matters. You know, I remember that.
You're like, I
love
moments. You, please do it.
Yeah, just kind of like, you know, so isolated socially and with my family who never understood me. Never understood that, you know, here's this random, misplaced, weird, eccentric, silly, goofy, passionate artist. You know, they never got it. You know, and so I was feeling so isolated, and immediately whenever I found a source that fed that part of me, it was cut off. And I remember being like, just give me some indication that you care about the decisions I make, that I am part of this picture. And this is, you know, like, I mean, we're talking, like, borderline suicidal, like, the impact I make. You know, give me some indication that it matters.
Right.
You know, wanting, desperately wanting to be a good person and make the right decisions. Asking this God,
who please I'm supposed show me to believe the way, in, right?
Give me some guidance.
Yeah. Because and you're nothing, like, I want to be such a good person. Can you just show me the way? Yeah. Because I don't know what is good. The world is very confusing. And the tools that I have to analyze this world are those of
they're
the
really
Bronze
corrupt.
Age.
They're
like,
so corrupt.
So stupid.
Yeah. And somehow, in my earliest years, I intuitively sensed that. But I couldn't develop those thoughts.
Right.
Because I had no reflection.
A 12-year-old can sniff out this bullshit.
Yeah.
Does not take fucking, like, the most enlightened individual to be like, I'm sorry, a talking donkey? What is this nonsense?
Yeah, show me some sign that it's true, that it's pure, that this is honesty, yeah, okay. You know? And I guess the path that I fell into was the fact that I was really craving brutal, raw honesty. You know, by that point, I wasn't so scared of the idea of life or death. I didn't want some insurance policy to tell me everything was going to be okay. It wasn't after that. I just wanted to be an honest, decent human being. And I wasn't finding it in the organization that claimed to be the only decent and honest human beings in existence.
But you still bought into it enough that...
I stayed.
You stayed in.
And that's
okay,
what
so
terrifies
from,
me
from,
more.
From,
and that's why I doubt myself.
But from your teenage years... Okay, so yeah. When these doubts begin, though, you're still a believer... And what, like, you're being educated how? Where are you going to school? Like, how does the education of your religious indoctrination conflict with the education that you're receiving? Like, did you go to a regular school? Like,
okay,
how did
so
it work?
So here's how, and this is where it gets more and more isolating. You know, my first couple of years of elementary were bad. I was breaking down. My parents had just gone through a divorce.
Right.
You know, picture this, 5 years old, my parents divorced. My dad just abandons us to a life of drinking and selfish pleasures. You know, my mother is so devout as a witness, or so she presents herself. I think she breaks her own rules more times than I can count, but, you know, she presents herself.
Whatever.
And I'm 5 years old. I don't know a lot better. Her support group are these other really devout witnesses who think, you know, we got to support this poor single family. You know, and so the first couple years of elementary, obviously, I didn't fit in to any community. I was so, like, emotionally irrational and confused. So by the time I was 7, my mom remarried this guy, moved us to Airdrie, moved us into this new, you know, this whole new town, this whole new community, new congregation of these Jehovah's Witnesses, new social structure at school. And keep in mind, you're told right from the time you're a toddler, you can't really be friends with the kids at school. You have to keep your distance. You're only there because you have to be. So by the time I was 7 and she remarried this man and turned our life upside down, I mean, and this is where it got confusing, was that there was a side of my mom who always understood the struggles I was going through and how isolated I was feeling, but then twisted it into her own interpretation, you know? So she recalls that time in my life and how it was such a beautiful moment, you know, that I was in tears saying to my mom, I think it was something like too many changes. I don't understand, but too many changes in this really breaking down, cryptic 7-year-old kind of way.
And thought it was beautiful.
She thought that it was, it was such a realization that she had just uprooted us and moved us to Airdrie and married this new man, so decided to homeschool me.
Well, that's not a good decision.
But offered it to me as though it was my decision, but presented it in such a way that, like, well,
enticed
like...
Enticed you to it?
I think you need this, but it's still your decision, Chris. And that's... I mean, we're talking about the way she presented it up until I finally had no contact with her anymore, was in such a loving, supportive way, but just simply put it, you know, in this... Well, yeah, you got punched in the face right in front of me at your schoolyard. Oh, that's so cruel. Like, kids, worldly kids are so cruel because they have no moral compass. Oh, like, well, like, don't do this unless you want to, but do you want to homeschool so you don't have to be punched in the face by worldly kids anymore?
Are you gonna make you're gonna make this kid an offer of candy fruit? What's yours? Hey, what are you gonna do about it, huh? Forget about it.
And of course, at the time, it was like, well, independent schedule, like, I could just do this. And, you know, she really took me in a way, you know, homeschooling me. That was her moment of, like, Your father abandoned you, your brother's at school, but I'm here helping you through this challenge because you went through so much because of what your father did that I'm here to save you.
So your brother and you had different experiences in terms of your own education?
Yeah, most simply put, not terribly different, but somewhat. And it's just... And
that how long did this homeschooling thing last for?
I homeschooled until in grade 10 I decided to work part-time, and then I wrote my GED when I turned 18. I never went back to public school.
Crazy.
Yeah, which is... You didn't expect that because I'm such a socially outgoing person.
Well, what do you mean I expect that? You know what? Yeah. Here's what's hilarious. You haven't listened to the show, but one of the episodes is where I read everyone my grades. And trust me, they're the most awful grades that you've ever seen in your life. I put up the show with the bad grades is because I wanted people who, you know, there are some out there, like younger audience or like the younger listeners that might think, oh, you know, Jacob's, he's smart and cool, blah, blah. What does he know? I mean, I don't necessarily think that that's true, but whatever. I mean, there are those that do. So I thought, here, let me show you how crappy my grades were.
Yeah.
Because there's people out there that are brilliant. I'm not saying I am, but there are people that out there that are brilliant that are either bored by school, they hate their situation.
But they're so disempowered.
They feel as though like how am I ever going to have a future because I have these horrible grades, these ideas
that are so ungodly.
I wanted to. I kind of wanted to just at least for any people that might potentially be inspired, say grades are not a reflection of your potential and your abilities.
That's touching on a really common mistake that people make when they leave a religion, is they cling to the monetary view of success or the business world's view of success, because that seems like the only alternative, and that's something I'm trying to communicate in everything I do, every interaction, in all my music, is that, you know, there's an alternative to that. And
well, there definitely is. I mean, you can choose for yourself your own future. It's just that a lot of times it's a really difficult choice. Mm-hmm. And it's very scary. But, I mean, going back to what we just talked about before, so you have finished, you're being homeschooled by your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And you're starting to have, obviously, your doubts. Yeah. What is the homeschooling experience like? What is its focus? Mm-hmm. What was she sort of really talking about? What was she trying to inculcate? Like, was it actually a pretty decent homeschooling? Like, did you cover a lot of the basics? Or was it really just you reading stuff on your own when you had to sort of, like, complete your equivalence test? Because, you know, you still have to know quite a bit to at least pass that. So how the fuck did you get to that point of knowledge? Like, how did you get there? Like, how's the road to that? Because you got homeschooled. Like, tell me the point where those two intercede.
Well, the tricky thing is you know, like, growing up as a witness, my mom did try to present everything as though, like, yeah, you need to be able to integrate the witness life into the secular world, you know? The scripture, paying back Caesar's things to Caesar,
right,
as a reference to paying your taxes. You know, so there's this point that as long as it doesn't interfere with your personal beliefs, you need to interact with that world as a basic type of survival. Which, I mean, again, that brings up a whole other, you know, list of questions.
Like, why is that necessary?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, my mother initiated the homeschooling. She taught me in grade 3. After that, I taught myself. So the first year, and it's kind of my mom's style, is that everything relates back to why it's such a good idea to be a witness, you know? So you could dig deep into, you know, how to manage a bank account with basic elementary math, but it all comes back into why it's such a good idea to be a witness, because you're not greedy, so you don't have to stress so much about this basic math, but you need to know it.
Well, if it's necessary, why do I need to know it?
Yeah.
The lifestyle's perfect, but you need to know this.
But you need to know this, because this is a situation we're forced into, obviously. So
we're sinners, what can I say.
Yeah, because we're imperfect, and it'll be resolved. Just trust that, Jacob.
Wait.
How you're going to recruit enough people to listen to your show to, you know, pay for your new condenser microphone. God will resolve that.
Yeah, exactly.
But you still need to be able to. You still need to be able to do it yourself.
Right. You will resolve it through you.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Suddenly,
he will make you do
suddenly
it.
You're God, but you're a pawn at the same time.
Right. I'm a pawn of God's actions. Fantastic. I have no say into it whatsoever, but I have to do all the work. Fantastic.
Naturally.
Sounds like a great deal.
It makes sense.
Can I bow down to this fucking entity? Let's do this. Yeah, I feel ready.
Okay.
You're educating yourself. My education how do you do this, though?
My mother went to, these, literally, met my teachers for homeschooling programs. I remember, going to these meetings where these poor kids are being homeschooled by their parents in grade 3, and my mom talking to teachers and being like, well, we have this religious belief, and of course, the public teaching world is pretty scared of when someone says, we got this background religious belief, and so they do their best to accommodate. So my mother got to basically choose and pick what I learned and what I didn't. So it was still a basic education. I could still go write my GED, but they're scared of being worldly. We talked about this before, and I think that's the scary thing about any organization like this. The idea of independent thoughts blooming or evolving into something greater is terrifying to the person, who clings to that religion for their own survival or clings to that group or organization. And, the idea of them being proved wrong by someone more intelligent is terrifying. And that's why a witness parent, is so scared to have their kids point out their basic fundamental flaws.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm scared of being a parent today. That's, essentially why. What business is it of mine to pass on my knowledge and experience? And because I got that, I got to understand why it was so challenging to be in that position.
But at the same time, when you're educating a child, if you decide to give to educate a child as a free thinker, they're not obligated to believe in any of the things that you tell them. But obviously, there are reasons behind what you're saying. You live a lifestyle, as a skeptic, as a person who's like, well, I demand evidence.
Yeah.
I live my life according to that. If a person tells me, what do you believe in? My answer is just merely
nothing.
Evidence.
Yeah,
I believe
evidence,
only in the and that process.
Well, the phrase that resonates with me, I think I shared with you before, is it is, a quote that I read that it's my firm belief that it is a mistake to hold firm beliefs. So that's my philosophy. So naturally, right. Religious people will hate me
and ostracize me. Understandably
yeah.
so. And if I had, there's a few beliefs that I might even classify as firm. But I do admit that there is a possibility for a person to talk me out of it. But, and this is the huge but, there's never going to be that one thing that's going to convince you. I mean, it's the same conversation I have with everyone where they're like, how are you going to convince people out there to abandon religion? I'm like, there is no single conversation.
Yeah, this one,
does not
as long as we're dragging this one episode on for.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the catalyst.
No. This is not what this episode
we're probably,
is about.
We're covering in my, like I said, over 20 years in a few minutes. It's going to be a long one, but it's still not going to be the kicker, and I don't want it to be, and I don't think you want it to be either.
I hope not. I would be disappointed.
My hope is in that I make someone stop and think for themselves. And
if they really take
that much out of what I think or what I experienced to change their decisions, their basic fundamental decisions in life, well, then they're an idiot, and they were screwed long before I came into the picture.
If you're making life decisions based on something that you heard from some person, and you're just like, that's it, I'm abandoning everything, I'm like,
you can't do that. And I always knew that, and that's why it took me so long to get out of it.
And
was
I
because I was so scared of making my decisions based off one experience or one person's perception. And that's why it took me so long to make the decision to completely step out of it.
It is difficult. And you know what? Every time I get a person that comes on the side and says, I don't think you really quite have understood Christ's logic. Because if you really understood it, then you would all believe and you're all dumb for not believing it. Which doesn't all necessarily sound any different from what I say. I'm not going to criticize it by saying you're using base arguments. Because I use base arguments. I don't mind doing it. It's am I aiming for some kind of intellectual, moral high ground? No! No, fuck it, because my opponents don't.
Yeah.
All right? They don't. I'm just going to fucking keep it real. But if in that process I'm, like, offending a few people, what can I say?
Yeah, well, that's going to happen. You're going to walk down the street with the wrong haircut or the wrong glasses. And
you're going to offend a few.
Yeah.
And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that.
If that's your base intention is to offend people, then
it's not my base.
There might be something wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's when I'm like...
That would be bad.
Yeah.
That would be bad.
But if you're like, I want to just make people upset and angry and rebellious, you know, And
that is definitely not my...
And that's why I'm skeptic of atheists and as much as I am skeptic of religions, you know, is because I need to see the intention behind it. It's for me more than evidence... I think the intention behind something is more important because we're all going to fuck up on the evidence and we're all going to fuck up on our own examples.
We're all retarded monkeys.
We're so stupid.
We're so stupid.
To even imagine
that we know the answers.
To concede that we might have a theory to explain the answers is so beyond retarded.
Like, every time we seem to get closer, there's just more questions. But here's the part that I find annoying. I remember that it's... Every once in a while, I get
an email.
Is
that window open again?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Let's close that window. Okay. Awesome. Isn't that better?
I'm reminded that every once in a while, I guess I have a tendency to overestimate what it is I know about the universe, right? Mm. Kind of because...
Overestimate or overportray?
No, I don't want
to... Because I sense with you that you still doubt your own thoughts, but you just don't want to
I would say overestimate, only because even if I actually did have a really good functional understanding, it's still a functional understanding that offers just more questions, sometimes even more uncertainties. But whenever I want to have the discussion about those things, the problem is now I have to enter a world where even discussing uncertainties about... Like, how do I think the universe ends? Just as an example, right? If I have to have this conversation and I have, you know, my certain doubts about a particular aspect of physical science, maybe I don't understand, or maybe is so mysterious that no one really pretends to understand.
And you you're leaving
yourself vulnerable to that point where you're saying, "Well, I don't know." And meanwhile, on the other side, whenever they hear that, they're like, "Well, I do." And it's right here in the Bible, and you're just like, they kind of bait you.
they bait you into trying to demonstrate that you're
closed-minded, just like me. And you're like, what the fuck,
feeding your insecurities.
Honestly.
Feeding them, like spoon-feeding the insecurities
that
you have.
That's all
that
they know
how
to do.
It's so brutal.
That's all they know how to do. And anyone who says they're immune to it, they don't even realize that there could be...
We were terrified.
Are you kidding me? You're poking at the fundamentals of any person. And I'm like, if you feel so confident in your belief structure, that you're like, I'm never going to change my mind, then let me tell you something. Something's wrong with your mind.
That's why I was so rejected and ostracized, even as a kid, is because I never fit in, because I always thought, there's something really wrong about this, you know? And what I was sensing intuitively as a child was the arrogance behind the idea that we know something as a, you know, what is it, 0.1% of the population that everyone else doesn't. And that always, like, that...
Well, that actually, atheists are much larger as a group than that.
And it is, but the idea of knowing that, like, oh, I have the answer to something you're kind of curious about that no one could really answer. Like, the whole implications of that. Like, humans have been kind of freaking out over this since as long as we had sentient thought. But in the past 130 years, there happens to be the correct answer. Here you go. Like, here, random man that I just woke up on a Saturday morning in your robe and your cup of coffee. By the way, I'm 14. Here's your answers, gentlemen. You're, you know, 3 times my age. It always bothered me. And I never could really sell it. You know, I remember being criticized as a kid by one of the elders, you know, as to how I stumbled people away and I should feel terrible because I couldn't really sell it when it got down to the point of, you know, studying the Bible with another person and teaching them the Bible. It's like, it took so much arrogance to do it, and I couldn't do that. I couldn't even fake it. So no one, I hope, and I think that no one that I ever, you know, studied the Bible with as a teenager really took me seriously, because I didn't. I was so insecure. I was so, like, self-doubting, you know, and then that was exploited. It was like, well, here's something to make you feel more confident.
Yeah.
Every time you doubt yourself, it's like, oh, well, can you take over sound for this week's church, by the way, Chris? You know, it was always, the more I was insecure, the more there was always a quick answer.
We can use them.
Yeah, just like, you know, you thinking, well, how am I going to provide for Carissa if I die in a motorcycle accident? And the life insurance agency is like, well, did you know? She'll be fine and beyond fine if there's any accident at all.
You were working during the traveling. Let's recap here. I just want to understand the chronology. By the time you're homeschool, where do you meet now? Tell me about this wife of yours. Okay? I need to know, who is this wife? Who is this woman? You said you were married.
I'm legally divorced.
There's obviously, and you said that you left at 21, okay. So you've obviously been
and
married
very young. Here comes my dissecting my own psychology and my own decision-making process at the time, and I guess I'm really...
Expose yourself.
Yeah. I couldn't just abandon this entire belief structure and this entire organization as a teenager, even though I saw where people were hurting each other, because there was an answer for that too. The idea was, you can't, and that's where their philosophy is correct, and that's why it was such a struggle for me to question it. You cannot blame an organization of people based on the experiences of yourself or one or two people within.
Because it could be the wrong experience.
You just
right?
can't.
You'd never know.
That's why it took me so long to leave. So the first place that I turned as a teenager into how to be a better person than what I was getting, how to be more loving than what I was receiving, how to give more, how to contribute to the basic human experience. You know, at the time I couldn't put that into words. But I thought, you know, I mean, the idea was, you know, when you marry someone as a Jehovah's Witness, that's when you get to be with them. That's when you get to sleep with them, you know. It's
yay, reward.
So the idea was marriage is a way to ultimately connect with a human being, you know. And that's what I intuitively sensed following their rules. But again, I couldn't really talk about what I was thinking and feeling and all the doubts I had. So I remember watching how my stepfather and my mother would interact and seeing the flaws, and like literally I was that 12-year-old sitting there thinking, when I get to the point, like, what can I learn from this?
Oh.
When I get to the point where I'm going to marry someone, what can I learn from this? So I really got to a point where I was idealistically giving and forgiving and loving and wanted to just take a risk, my own risk, for someone else, because I had this idealistic thought that people need that, because I never saw it, and I never felt it. I watched how my parents treated each other, how they treated friends of mine, how, you know, all these individual experiences, but that was in an organization that claims to be the most loving and welcoming and open.
So let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
So what you're saying now is that you didn't have, you had a fantasy version of what love is, and decided to try to apply that fantasy version to whatever relationship you wanted to attach yourself
essentially,
to.
Essentially, yes.
Okay. And who was this person? Who was this woman? What was she like?
Oh,
jeez. Am I tearing you open, Chris? I'm eviscerating you.
I mean, you're literally... I remember I burned these journals that covered this years ago.
Sorry, you're going to hate me by the end of it. When you re-listen to this, you're like, I can't release any of the things that I said.
And I'm supposed to edit this.
I'm supposed
to listen to this.
Do you know what that is? See, this is why I am
It feels
devil.
Like narcissism to me, but you're telling
devil.
Me this is okay.
I am the devil.
Yeah.
I am forcing you to bury your soul.
That's why you're an apostate, Jacob. That's why
I'm just cruel.
My parents would be so scared if they listened to this.
Oh, I would fuck their shit up.
Let's
want to hear about this girl. All right. Now, I'm imagining, and you tell me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
Because I probably am. But I'm imagining at the point where you are an insecure young man who has, you know, obviously you feel a particular type of rejection from your father, that the religion is exploited. You feel you're probably creative, and then you worry about how you're going to connect with another human being.
And at this point, I'm also rejected by my mom and my stepdad because I missed 2 weeks of church.
Just let me guess. Don't fill in the blanks, all right? Don't fill in the blanks because I'm just guessing. Okay. We have not discussed this story before, so I'm still just guessing. So at this point, I'm assuming that because of the influence of the young man, what's his name again? Your young friend when you were 11. What was his name?
Keenan.
Keenan. Okay. So yeah, Keenan,
even the name wasn't.
So Keenan himself, like, if he's so influential, it leads me to believe that there are very few other interceding relationships that had such an influence on you.
No, there was always one.
There was one?
There was always one. And even when I left, there was always one. And if it
hold on, you're filling in the blanks here. You're filling in the blanks.
You're right. You're just making assumptions.
I'm making assumptions.
You're being religious about this. Okay.
I'm not even listening to that point.
You're not listening to the guy on the street. Hey, guy who actually knows what he's talking about.
Fuck you. I'm the one crafting this story
Okay.
So in this story, I imagine that you're having a very difficult time being able to connect with another female. So you probably make some kind of assumptions about how that process plays out, right? I think you created these types of imagined roles that you are going to fulfill and a kind of imaginary relationship that you are going to seek. So whoever this person that you sought probably was someone who represented at least this imagined, you know, Jetsons world that you had created. Does that sound... No? Totally wrong. Well, I knew I was wrong halfway, but I'm trying to uncover this sort of, what is she like? I'm like, I can only guess that something that would be very, very consistent with a conservative worldview. So is she like,
to an extent, yes.
Yeah. Is she like the typical mom, like apple pie baking on the fucking side of a windowsill kind of thing?
No,
like,
but that's who my best friend married. And that's why we get into a lot of discussions with that.
So what did you want? And what did you get? Did you get what you wanted at the time?
What I wanted didn't come into the picture in my mind.
No?
Frankly, from the time I was that 11-year-old, like, starting to realize how passionate I was and the fact that I couldn't speak about that or how eccentric I was, what I wanted wasn't what I was after. It wasn't what I could get out of a situation. That's where... To this day, it's got me in a lot of trouble because, you know, after I experience something that I think no one deserves to experience, that I see a worse example, and I just give, and I give, and give, and give, and give, and give, because I want to give what I never had.
Right.
I mean, that's...
You empathize strongly.
It's all empathy. So what I wanted was an example, but who I wanted to be as a human being was an example. And, of course, the most potent...
Source
example,
of inspiration was Jesus?
No, was how you could be as a husband, even when I was, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, how I interacted as a husband. And I knew from the time I was really young that I didn't want to have kids because, frankly, my parents really missed the mark, and I hated the idea of being a parent. I didn't want to do that to someone else.
I have loving parents, but I still feel the same way.
I'm like, or intentionally,
my parents were loving, and I don't want to let anyone else go through that. That was awful.
You know, I look at Bill Murray in The Life Aquatic, you know, Wes Anderson's movie, where he said, when his son asked him, essentially, you must have known you were my father. Why didn't you try to contact me? And he said, because I hated fathers, and I never wanted to become one. You know, and it's funny because Wes Anderson, being how he is, immediately made a really comical moment after that. But the potency of that statement really resonated with me. And I always had this idea of the fact that in the most intimate and close way, I could give to someone the love that I think humanity needed, that I thought we all needed, that kind of forgiveness, that kind of understanding. You're starting to see how dangerous of a thought process this is. Because in a way, I jump to the other extreme. It's way too much.
That no human being can be like that. I mean, what I find...
Nothing. Go on.
No human being can live by the ideals that have been set up, and I think that that's that kind of hilarious symptom of religion, where they're like, well, you're sinful because you can't be this perfect.
By default.
You're by default because by you, can't default. Be, you can't be this perfect. Can you forgive, turn your back on your enemy? What the fuck are you talking about? So he can stab me in the back? Like, who designed this? This is a stupid rule. Now, I can understand
And see, I was always intuitively, you know, I remember always thinking there was no exceptions to every rule. And my first example of that was how my parents enforce rules. Every time they would get more scared, especially when my brother left home, and that's a whole other topic, but, you know, he left in a rebellious rampage when he was 14. I was 11. He also gave my mother more and more fears. My stepfather catered to my mother's fears. That was how it worked. So I remember always thinking in all these really intense, rigid rules that there's always exceptions to every rule. I remember my mother kicking friends of mine that I sensed such a genuine good spirit in them. And to this day, there's one who later was the only person to, like, really stick by my side in the most challenging moments. We're very different people, but I can't acknowledge and stress more how much of an inspiration his openness was. I remember when I was 16 and befriended him, and he would come over with his girlfriend, my mother being pulling me upstairs, you know, telling me, and my stepfather being there, backing her up, you know, like, very firmly, and they have to leave now. You know, this basement suite, which at the time I paid rent to live in separately from them and worked part-time jobs to support myself because we couldn't see eye to eye. So I suggested, why don't we step back? I'll live in the basement for a while. Me, 16, yeah, coming up with family solutions. But, yeah, you know, my friends coming over, and then my parents pulling me upstairs and being like, he's got to go. And I'm like, why? Well, because he's not baptized and he's dating someone. You know, and me being like, but you haven't heard what he's gone through. Like, you know, there was this basic empathy of the fact that they had just opened up to me as a couple, what they went through just to be together. You know, this kind of how much openness there was to the fact that there's always exceptions, that we're all humans, that we're going to make mistakes, which is what this religion promised.
That was part of the package deal. What's happening?
Which is what it was, you know, I was raised to think this way by these morals, but I remember arguing with my parents and being like, but if we blindly kick them out, what kind of impression is this going to give? You know, I remember being like, you're saying you're concerned that he's not doing things the right way, so we immediately reject and abandon him? And I remember being like, but
who benefits from this?
Yeah, and I remember them then, after saying this to me, while my friends are still, you know, this young kid and his girlfriend are still waiting downstairs in the basement, you know, them saying to me, you can't tell him that we told you to kick him out, and you can't tell him why.
Oh, so you have to lie now.
So now I have to lie. I'm like, but he's going to ask. They're like, well, just don't say anything. I'm like, then that's lying. And they're like, well, no.
Well, clearly they're ashamed of what's going on.
Yeah, they were like, you know, putting me in this position of saying, you can't be in our house, part of which I happen to work and pay rent for. By the way, guys, I can't say why. To people who they thought needed more spiritual guidance. And I thought, you know, I remember thinking of how hypocritical that was. And then I thought, but that's not what this organization is teaching. So there I was caught in that dilemma of, do I blame the individual or do I blame the organization for the symptomatic behavior of the individual? I was always aware of that. I was always aware of that dilemma every time I doubted it. So I remember going downstairs and immediately standing up and taking my friend's side because I just heard what he went through and how much he was trying to be this faithful witness.
Well, what are you supposed to do? I mean, like...
So I went downstairs and I was like, honestly, I'm just going to give it to you straight. I'm not allowed to tell you this. This is where my parents stand, and I am so sorry. And immediately, I took on the burden. I was trying to think of ways to be the better friend and set the example and show them that we're not this abandoning and we're not supposed to be this cold. And I had no way of doing that because my parents found a way to totally cut him out of my life. And then he ended up being the only person whose house I could go to or who I could call years later when I stepped out of it.
I can't imagine those people that are still stuck where they don't have that opportunity. They don't have those options. I would suggest to those people, I hope some of them are listening, because this one is access. Like, you can have access to it if you try hard enough. All you got to do is give me an email address, honestly. If you don't have one, I don't even know, what are you doing in the internet?
You're crazy. Doesn't make sense, yeah.
But to imagine that there are actually, there can be people out there that will provide some support, it really just, it involves just you communicating with other human beings. And the thing that happens is that their empathy generally sort of like tends to take over. So you have to encourage people out there, the ones that aren't participating, the ones that, you know, like the ones that just listen. Yeah. You know, they're not participating yet, but they need to, because participating in that is the way that you're going to be able to build that support network of people that you want into your life. You have that option, man. That could be your fucking future. Forget about everything else, okay? Family, as far as anyone else is concerned, if you're stuck in a position where you have to make that fucking option, family is whatever it is that you create and how you decide to make it. And anybody else that doesn't want to be in that family, and when you offer that olive branch, they're not fucking welcome. And that's just how you have to deal with it. But there's plenty of people out there that are willing to be part of it. That's the truth.
I think that we're decent guys sitting here right now talking about this, even though we don't believe in one specific religion. You know, I'd like to think that I have gone out of my way for my friends, that I have understood
basic human empathy.
Yeah, and that's what I was always raised to think there wasn't. So I was drawn to this, you know, I mean,
paranoid kind of
not
fearful.
Not so much paranoid, but I just understood intuitively the importance of basic human empathy and the fact that is more important than any cold and hard rule. You know, understanding, being able to forgive someone truly, or understand why they did something. And so I was drawn to this, and so the ultimate way I could express this while still being in the confines of a Jehovah's Witness was to be married to someone.
But I mean, who is this girl? Who was she? What was she like? Is it hard to discuss?
No one's ever asked to such detail.
She pretty?
Yeah, she was pretty. I mean, in my terms of pretty. I mean, we're talking like a, you know, pretty subjective here.
I know, but I mean, it doesn't matter. I'm not asking you whether or not
she
I have to have sex with her.
To be honest, she took a genuine interest in me. She was probably the first person that, you know, I guess that I could connect with romantically that saw.
She made the move.
It was pretty mutual.
Mutual? Okay. Yeah. So there was a natural chemistry there.
There was First off, you know, as a witness, you're with the person you marry for the rest of your life. So if they even mentioned chemistry in the congregation, you know, there'd be a bunch of 16-year-olds up in arms being like, how do I know? They can't answer that. So yeah, the first person I had any chemistry with, you know, to be sure. But even then...
How excited were you, like, during the romance part of it? Was it kind of like, was it exciting? Was it like, was it really good? Or were there lots of things that in retrospect seem like warning signs?
Well, the things that were warning signs were all connected to the set of rules that was imposed on me from birth. You know, so I was trying to show that I could think outside of that box. And in doing so, it's like saying no to one option and suddenly there's 1,000 more before you and trying to make the best possible decision that you can. So that, yeah, there were warning signs, but the warning signs seemed within my ability to be forgiving and loving enough to overcome them.
Right, it wasn't outside.
But I also, I mean, and this is very little known, but I married her within, you know, 4 months of meeting her.
It's a pretty short romance.
It's extremely short. And, like, again, the reason for that was simply because I wanted to give it a fair chance, just in case, that it could be something really important, because there was a reason to be with her. There was a reason. I felt drawn, and I wanted to give it a chance before I discredited it. But the only way to really do that, especially once we realized that there was chemistry and we started breaking rules, was to just get married. You know, so...
Did you break all the rules, or did you only break some?
I mean, you don't have any idea how many rules there are.
I can only imagine. But, I mean, generally speaking...
Well, I was excommunicated for the first time because of the rules I broke then, but we got married first. So for 8 months, the only person I had any legitimate communication with was her. So in a way, it's, you know, it's funny. You could go back and be like, well, there was all these warning signs, but then you'd be like, well, that also was the catalyst for me seeing the bigger warning signs, the warning signs of the bigger picture, far beyond my own romances, about my own view of human behavior and life. And,
but let's get. Yeah. I mean, at the end of it, I mean, this could be. I mean, obviously, this is a very personal question, but the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it was? Was there genuine love, or do you think that it was lust portrayed as a kind of romantic ideal that you were just suddenly caught into, or like an incompatibility?
Oh, you're asking me, did I get married for the wrong reasons?
Right.
Yes.
I had a genuine compassion
for this woman. I really
did she, by the way? Was it like genuine? Like, was the compassion genuine on both sides?
There was in certain ways, yeah. But as soon as I married her, there was also a lack of compassion that threw me into a whole other dilemma.
She became a different person after marriage.
Yes.
Yeah. She became herself.
Yes.
Right. And herself was, what type of person was herself?
Just someone who was emotionally insecure enough to cling on to the ideals of the larger group. She wasn't really herself. It was something she clinged on to. And that's the kind of person I tend to attract. I have had the same kind of basic human values, and in some ways, I guess, emotionally, I've already kind of gone through the worst of discovering that I need to be me at the end of the day. You know, I've come to that realization, and I do the best I can to do that. So I attract people who need that, but those people often haven't confronted their emotional stresses and traumas.
Right.
They're not as cathartic as I am. And that's not necessarily right or wrong, because I think it's a curse some days. But they're just simply not as cathartic as I am. I have this, you know, ideal that I need to confront everything, to face it, to in order to heal from it. And so I tend to attract people who need that really badly. You know, but then because of that, it all kind of comes out on me. So, you know, a few days after marriage, when I didn't finish unpacking a box because I just happened to get, you know, a severe case of mono for a month.
So you were exhausted and just
deadly ill, and the most ill I've ever been in my life. And like, so, you know, this is my realization. The first one was, you know, I had to unpack this one box of all these tiny miscellaneous items because I wanted to go through it. Kind of like I do with my emotions. I want to, if I'm going to face it, I'm going to face it all. I'm going to organize it. I'm going to get rid of everything I don't need and, you know, organize this box, you know? And it hadn't been unpacked yet. It was, I guess it was an eyesore in the living room. And I have memories of her, like, throwing the bed frame on the ground and breaking a few, like, CDs in a stack and storming out of the house and getting angry at me, even though I was deadly ill with mono and literally in bed, you know, seeing that she had no capacity to emotionally react to things that scared her. Which is most witnesses, because they've clinged on to an illusion, you know, as a way to emotionally react to something that scares them. Uncertainty, right? So they have all these answers, but if they're not real, and that reality gets shattered, which it always will and always does, it's scary as hell.
They always react less, like they're less than what they can actually be. Like you would say, in any other circumstance, this person would never have behaved in any of the, you know, in any of the way that they did. It would never have come to what it came to. But really, at the end of the day, anytime something wrong happened, because they were so ill-equipped, because they were infantilized,
mm-hmm.
with this just idiotic notion, completely and utterly unable to deal with real adult situations.
Mm-hmm.
So you were two infants. So you lived? Were you living in your own apartment? Were you living in the basement in the beginning of your
The marriage? No, it was our own apartment.
It was your own apartment. I mean, so
I had to do things on my own. This is after my parents decided to kick me out of the basement suite.
So now you have a good taste of, like, you have a bit of that first fear. Like, was it like gripping, or just only a like, huh? Or was it like a, oh god? Was that kind of like a what the fuck is?
Really idealistic.
Right.
You know, I still realized how important giving someone genuine forgiveness and love was. That I thought it was almost hippie, in the sense that, like, I thought if I give this person enough, they'll be able to deal with this. You know, they'll be able to heal. You know, and I cared about her that much. You know, I genuinely cared about her well-being enough that I didn't just take any incident as an example of the whole. Same way.
No, obviously you can't.
You can't. So, that's like, even when I was a teenager and dreaming of what it would be like to be a husband, I knew that there would be a lot of disagreements and trauma and struggle and strife and fears and insecurities. Somehow, I always knew that, and in some way, I welcomed them. It was a challenge to put my own values to the test. You know, it was like a way of being everything. It was an opportunity to be everything that I saw was lacking. I literally took the weight of what I saw wrong morally with the entire world on my shoulders.
It's not uncommon, especially in very, very young, early age, especially if you're an ideologue, to really take that. Because I think that in a certain respect, this for us represents our own sacrifice. We sacrifice our well-being in our own minds in exchange for trying to take the weight of the world upon our shoulders.
But yeah, really, and it's not because we want to be a hero or a savior, because it's not an ego thing. It's a genuine, passionate empathy thing.
Right, exactly.
You're not like, you don't see yourself getting rewarded for giving something. It doesn't come into the equation. And for me, it didn't, because I saw what was wrong with giving out of ego, which is essentially what religion's doing, is giving out of pure ego.
The only thing egotistical that I could say
is that we somehow believe we're able to.
No, it's not even that. Yeah. It's just that you sometimes, with genuine, compassionate actions, there is a tendency for the feeling to almost feel so good that you're addicted to it, this is a selfish thing. You're like, oh, I like the capacity to feel empathy for someone when they are in a dire situation goes both ways. When you experience their adulation, their fucking their own ecstasy, and you are somehow part of that ecstasy, you will feel it too, man.
And it can become an addiction. Hell, just like fucking, a drug, yeah. Just like alcohol, yeah.
It's like the best drug. I mean, yeah. The drugs that you
that's
take...
That's what MDMA addicted. Was designed to create.
I mean, forget about it. The best drugs don't introduce chemicals in your brain that aren't already there. They just exploit them.
Exactly,
so the ability to feel those emotions, the high of heroin exists, and those sometimes are... Like, it's a weird feeling. A person can feel like, oh, I really got more out of that than the person that I helped. And you're just like, no, you didn't. No, actually, yeah, I did. Because I empathize. And that's that weird.
And that's what scares me. That's what scares me, is I have this genuine desire to help, but I also understand how that could go to my head. And that's what I'm really scared of, is, you know, the falling into an illusion, and that's what I saw around me, and that's why I witnessed so much suffering and isolation, was just simply people falling into illusions that were based on their own fears and their own ego and their own perception of reality. And so that's why it's hard for me to really discuss this in such detail.
What can I say? I probe deep. So how long did this marriage last, by the way?
A year and a half, technically.
So was there, like, near the end of it, like, was there a significant change? Was it a gradual thing? Or was there just, you know, like, even in the marriage itself?
Like everything else, I don't make decisions really rapidly. No, you know, I obviously respected what a commitment was. And I obviously understood that you don't give up at the first sign of trouble. So obviously,
I really tried
to make it work. One, because I cared about her. Secondly, because it was just the right thing to do. Because I would regret not trying something to its fullest. If I'm going to try something, I have to just do it.
Have you talked to her since the divorce?
Yes. Well, since the separation, since the actual legal divorce, no. She won't talk to me because I'm...
Outside of, like, right.
Yeah, I'm excommunicated.
She's still into that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And let me ask you this question. If she suddenly were to fall out of that religion... Would that fundamentally change things, or would it still just be a terrible idea
to be with her
if she had removed that shackle? Or would you be strangers? Would you be strangers in that world?
I don't want to. It's funny how to describe this honestly without sounding really arrogant.
No. So
if you're, in the most basic, I sound like such a douche saying it, but in the most straight up terms, when you've struggled your whole life to be 8 runs up a ladder that you see yourself getting towards the top, and you know, as scary as it is that high up, that you got to keep going, is it really that tempting for you to step back to the second run? Is it really, like, why? It's either jump or keep going. I learned so much in that experience that I can't regret it, and I also can't look back to it. It's almost... At this point,
it's a different world.
At this point, it's almost like looking back on another man's dreams. It's like seeing a filmmaker's communication of what his reality is. It's so surreal. It's not you. It's
well. Here's what I always found was kind of hilarious about who we are is that it takes about 9 years for every single cell in your body to
self-replicate.
So in a sense, if you haven't seen anyone for longer than 9 years, there is nothing about you
that
is
the not same, a single cell.
Not a single fucking cell.
Which includes your brain cells, which means your entire being.
Your entire being. Yeah. Now we like to think of ourselves. I thought it was 7 years. No, I believe it's 9. Last time. I could be wrong. In any case, if I am.
Either way, it's not very long.
It's not very
long. It's longer than probably all the listeners have.
Actually almost as long as when I started doing this. The organism that began the Good Atheist
is a completely
different person. And to think that we are this static individual is ludicrous. Mm. We, even our consciousness...
It's very disempowering. It's disempowering. And that's... Yeah. I mean, if you're going to cling on to a sheep mentality, you've got to be very disempowered to do so. And that's what's scary about these organisms, these machines... You know, of a religion or a cult or a way of life.
The machines that we fight against, my friend, that the reason why this podcast exists, the reason why we have at least enough bonus podcast members, the very listeners that listen right now, that we can make this possible. I'm not saying I'm living a comfortable lifestyle. I think that Chris can testify to the fact that you learn to live frugally when you do what I do.
Yeah, you really, really do.
Everything is scrutinized, bitches. Everything is scrutinized. So you leave that world. You make your decision slowly, and I guess day. What was that day like? Let's rewind the day where you're like, okay, I'm gone.
Yeah, I'm done.
Talk to me about that day.
The friend that ended up asking me, why did you take my side? The friend that was over at my parents' basement when I was, you know, living in their basement.
Yes, yes.
They kicked out. You know, years later, he asked me. He was just curious as to how, against all odds, against all these influences, that I stepped up and thought, this isn't right, and stood up for it, and lost everything, right? And, you know, he had already kind of done that, but in his own way, it was an easy thing for him, because he never totally committed. He was raised in this, but he did his own thing.
But he still understood the difficulty.
But he understood the difficulty.
Enough
and
inside
guilt.
That he knew what it was.
Yeah, very, you know, aware. You and I are friends just simply because we're so, you know, empathetic with one another. You know, we don't have a lot else in common, but we understand that struggle. This goes into, like, my big illuminating factor was in seeing how people tried to tell me to treat people that I really understood or resonated with. And, you know, I always had these friends who weren't quite, they were still following it and practicing it, but they thought very individually. And so it was always an inspiration to me because, like, my eccentric creative side needed that so bad.
Wanted to be part of that world.
Yeah, and really just needed to express something a lot more important, I think. There was this one day, I mean, I was, you know, by this point I was married. I had just applied to buy a house with another young married couple. I was living in the deep suburbs of the city, financing a car, wasting my money every month. I always wanted to go to, like, the UK and Europe, specifically because of musical connections I was making there.
Which you plan to in the future, right?
Which I'll be doing this year. Yeah,
how are you set up like that? Do you know how you're going to make it through, or are you just...
No,
sort of like
I just know I'm going to do it.
Okay, well, you know what? I think that anybody... Here's anybody... Like, there's plenty of fans in the UK that if you like Chris, by the way, help this guy out. No, seriously. I want you guys that listen to the show. There's definitely a huge contingency in the UK, and I plan on getting there. So if anybody can make his transition there easier, guess who's going to follow him to the UK? This motherfucker. But it's something that it's going to be hard. So he wants to really seriously go. I'm probably about a year away from being able to do so. So if he can be set up there and he lives there, I'm going to mooch off of him. So if you can help this motherfucker accomplish this dream.
Which is greatly appreciated.
I mean,
I'm still scared every day of how I'm going to come up with a plane ticket without any family support.
You're going to be fine, man. Yeah. Like, listen, you're going to go over there. You're going to have a sexy accent. They're going to fucking love you over there.
I hope we're novel. So. Yeah.
No, we are totally novel.
Yeah, we'll be playing, yeah.
Totally. They're like, we love your accent.
My deal for anyone that puts me up there while I'm touring with my music is that I'll play them an intimate acoustic show, which is very difficult for me. But I just want to play for people personally, and I also want to give them any CDs I have on hand.
That is all determined by how good this podcast is. Yeah, it'll be a reflection, but here's the good news. This podcast is so long, and I'm assuming you can make it as long as you want, by the way, because trust me, the bonus people, they love a long show, and they'll listen to it in a few little segments. If you want to break it up, you know how it is. You've run a festival before. You fucking just apply the same techniques. Just do the same thing. And if it really is worth it, I think that anybody that is in the UK that can help you that doesn't do anything about it, I don't even want them as a fan. They would disgust me.
If it was within their fucking power to do something, I'm like, get the fuck out of here.
But only if it's that good.
Useless.
Only if it's that good. I don't know what it's going to be like. The pressure. I'm not the one fucking... Exactly.
After giving me a two-day deadline and a three-hour podcast, he said, make this enticing, will you?
I have no choice.
Okay.
That is... if I do not put it up in that time, I feel too late.
In that case, we need to digress.
Well, we're almost done.
So what was that day like?
Tell me about that day.
By this point, 8 months earlier, I remember a very, melodramatic moment with my wife where I literally took my ring off and threw it on the table in front of her, maybe the sidewalk. I think we're sitting outside, and I said, either learn to emotionally react in a more empathetic way with me, either you learn to be patient so I could help you with these problems so we can get through this as a team, or I have to go because I'm breaking down, because I have nothing left to give anymore. I've been patient and giving and supporting in this emotional and mental way to the point where I saw any ambitions I had crumbling before me. Even back then, even though I wasn't confident in myself, I knew that logically if I get to the point where I'm impatient, she gets angry at me in the kitchen, if I yell back, there's no point. You got to step back from
that.
You're
just gonna absorb all of that.
I spent a week at my friend's house at one point just to take a few days, and that was a big thing for her. Like, seeing her, kind of like the hold she had on the fact that she could get away with this and continue being irrational because I was married to her because of the rules, that was kind of this awakening moment of like, but I still don't agree with it if it's mutual abuse. I just can't. There's always exceptions to every rule.
You can't continue to justify the relationship.
I can't be a jerk and feel good about staying with this person. Like, that's the right thing to
do. It's not the right trade-off.
It's not. And the idea of hurting someone else but doing it out of obligation just makes no sense to me, especially someone that I took a wedding vow to. And
something you generally care about.
Yeah, and I really do to this day. I really do think about her and, like, hope that she's happier, hope she's doing better. And... So the biggest moment was when her emotional outrage and basically like emotional and verbal abuse, when she would lose her temper verbally, when that got to the point where she took it to the realm of physical abuse. Her parents were visiting from Prince George, and I remember taking them out for coffee and interacting with them, but I was in the middle of trying to build this business. And I mean, this is where the creative side of me was fighting over this organization was. I was trying to build a part-time business that would enable me to devote more time to this new, very new pursuit at the time, by the way, of music. I just bought this software and this keyboard and this interface and thought, I need to create music. I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea how to do this.
But I want to do it.
But I need to do it. And so I realized I needed to free up more time to do it. So I was in the middle of building this part-time janitorial business. As I was still paying for, renting a condo in the Southwest, looking at buying a condo,
the white picket fence stuff,
the idea of financial security, which doesn't exist, by the way, it's a total waste. But I was trying to live within the confines of everyone else's rules, but still do what I needed to do. But that still frustrated her. The idea that she would have friends over and say, oh, where's Chris? Oh, he's working. Oh, but it's 9 o'clock on a Sunday night. Why is he working? The idea of that conversation over a glass of wine with friends terrified her, because that's so unusual after all. So there
Yeah, you call that unusual, I call that fucking interesting. It's like, yeah. I don't want to have interesting conversations and to describe some of the things that my husband is doing. Yeah. I want everything to be so boring that the conversations can be written by a computer program.
Exactly, and that's, I never felt quite myself in that. I mean, I've never been 16 years old, living with my parents, like a normal, well-fed human being who was getting bronchitis four times a year because he was so stressed out trying to fit into it. Man. It just, I was so sick. I was literally physically sick, you know, and...
Did you get a lot of stress hives and those kinds of things, or mostly illness?
Like, mostly illness, but it was definitely to the point where there was stress hives and there was, like, a lot of illness. Like, people thought I had all these major lung issues. Now I could, you know, freely smoke a tobacco pipe every few days, terribly break the rules, and know that I'm not going to get sick this year. You know, but back then it was like, oh, geez, like, oh, it's this, oh, this terrible world we live in where these innocent people, you know, are you know, exposed to secondhand smoke. That's why he's getting bronchitis four times a year.
So you have this conversation with him, you put the ring down, you're like... That's it.
That was about 8 months before. No, that was about eight months before I actually did. It was, it was my way of saying, like, this is getting to this point.
Put the foot
point.
Down like, in a really long...
Down. It wasn't like a threat or an ultimatum. It was just a warning to her. And it was me saying, I mean, even 8 months before, this can't sustain itself the way it's going. And I'm trying to do everything I can on my end. I need a little more help from you.
And her response to this was...
Oh, well, that's why it lasted so long. It's because... She would bounce from, you know, freaking out at me and screaming and then realize that that's not the way to do it and then beat herself up. She had the kind of, like, a low self-confidence.
Was she, like, part of the Opus Dei kind of thing?
She was just basic idea of creating that which you're scared of, which that kind of psychology isn't really addressed as a witness because that's what they're doing. If they educated you as to why you need to confront your emotional fears in order to get over them or heal from them, the organization wouldn't exist. Like,
there would be no room for it.
There's not the emotional guidance in that sense of how to heal just psychologically from your trauma. She was a sexual abuse victim. She had a lot of abandonment issues. Her parents were the very normal parents, typical 9-to-5 witness parents, but even then she couldn't understand why she, you know, had all these fears of abandonment. And I tried to take it all on. I understood. I empathized. I was patient. But I realized I can't help someone heal if I'm done for, if I'm screaming back at them.
Right.
It's useless.
So the
catalyst.
It was the beginning of the end. So that there's an 8 month process of that. But eventually there is a day where you leave.
Yeah, and that day, and that's what you're asking. But yes. I feel like if I had expressed this,
I understand. But let's talk about that. Yeah. Day. So we understand the context. So it's a slow process. But yeah. The day. Tell me
her
about the
parents,
day.
Her parents were visiting from Prince George. I was trying to build this business. I was working part time at Starbucks. I was working full time. Not making much money with the initial contracts of building this business, and I was working another third cleaning job on the side because I was in the middle of it. I was killing myself working so hard. But even then, her parents came out to visit for a few days. I, you know, went out of my way to try to just, like, be as hospitable as I could. You know, we gave them our room in the apartment, and, like, I remember taking them out for coffee and trying to open up to them. But I was dealing with so much. You know, I was stressed out. This, like, frankly... You know, this marriage was seeming more and more hopeless. I was still trying to do the right thing and be responsible. I didn't want to retaliate against anyone, so I had that whole thing going on. So I was stressed out and breaking down and basically working constantly, but still going to church and still, you know, going out for dinners and coffee with her parents. And then this one day, I remember it was a Friday morning, maybe a Thursday morning, where, like, it was early in the morning. It was about 9 o'clock, I think, that my good friend who had helped me, he had been there as a non-biased support for both of us more times than I could count. You know, he was literally, like, I would, you know, Ian would go and pull her aside and explain where I was coming from and then do the same for me. He was just this incredibly, you know, non-biased good support and good friend for both of us.
So my
gratitude to him went out. Beyond reason by this point. You know, my loyalty to him was huge, and he called me up this morning and breaking down. I had never heard him in that state. Like, literally, like, hyperventilating in tears, so stressed out because of, like, stuff he was going through. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, here's this pillar of support for both of us. And, like, I remember, like, my wife was right beside me, hearing his voice and hearing my reaction to it on the phone. And I was like, you know what? Like, I'm doing a shift at Starbucks tonight. I will, like, come over and hang out with you as long as you need after that. You know, like, literally, like, you know, and the first moment of free time I had, I'm like, I'm yours. Like, don't worry. You know, and I remember, like, getting off the phone, and immediately she was, like, so annoyed with me and lecturing me. She's like, my parents are out visiting. And I was like, but they're happy, and, like, you could hang out with them and get some one-on-one time with them. Like,
this is a big deal.
This is a huge, like, do you realize how much, like, our marriage would not still be in existence if it wasn't for this guy, this young guy who was literally breaking down? Like, how can I not?
You're asking me to do the same thing that had led you to really start to separate yourself from it. Like, a moment where you decided that you could not tolerate the hypocrisy of what they were asking.
Exactly.
Because the incompatibility of their own message was too much to bear. Yeah. It's like, I would rather break your covenant and do the right thing. And I don't even understand, you know, it's funny because religious people have never really understood the difficulty of actually doing as a human being. They haven't yet stepped into those into those fucking shoes where you're like, when you step outside of that comfort zone where you're like, I'm going out on a limb here and I'm going to do something because I think it's the right thing to do. For a lot of people that are in situations, in religious environments, doing that is so huge of a fucking deal. Like, guys like me can barely comprehend it. I hear it second fucking hand. I'm not part of that world.
Yeah.
I'm the privileged few, Chris, that have not had to go through the bullshit.
And you are, and you're very lucky. But, yeah, at this time, and again, it's one of those situations where it's like, well, I can't blame the religion, because according to the textbooks, I was making the right choice. But it was just pissing her off, you know? And she was super, like, pouty, and that's, you know, that's where she started, like, pushing me away, and that's where all those things came up, and then, like,
leaving
super, super sarcastic messages on my phone while I'm at work, like, coming into my work and just giving me that look, like, going out of her way to make me feel so guilty for the fact that I committed to spending an evening with this friend in need, you know, and she had her parents. It's not like I was leaving her alone. It's not, and that's where it's like, I went out of my way for this person for a year and a half. I step up when someone actually needs me more, and that's the kind of response, and that was, you know, that was always an issue, and it wasn't. And that's why it's so hard to communicate, because it could be misperceived as me saying, like, oh, I want to go hang out with my buddies and do whatever I want. I never did that. I never thought that way. But when you hear someone you care about that much breaking down in tears, and, you know, the person you're with is annoyed.
There should be no discussion or to justify why you need to make time for
friends. And even then, I still explained. I was so nice. Even when she was being sarcastic and, like, you know, pouting, and, like, I don't want to seem like I'm making gender stereotypes, because I think men are the biggest pouts and guilt trippers of all time. But, you know, when she was pouting and angry, I still took the time trying to rush and get ready to go to work and go on with my day, explaining to her that, like, I'll be back tomorrow. We'll do some stuff tomorrow. Like, I gotta go out of my way here. Like, you know, and explaining, like, he needs us. He's reaching out, and
it's not just my duty as a friend. It is in a way.
Needs us.
You know what it is?
There was
though?
No question. There was never a moment in my mind of, like, is this the right thing?
It's not just your duty. In a sense, in any friendship, it's actually the privilege of friendship is to be there for friends when they need you. Because as much fun as friends can be hanging around them, really what we need friends to do is be there in those moments of crisis. Because everyone else is just a fucking acquaintance that you're just hanging around with. The people that are friends are the ones that show up when you're like, something horrible happened.
And think about the amount of trust this guy puts in me, you know? He's always taking that position of being the strong guy, you know? A couple of years older than me, kind of almost always had a big brother role to me in a way. And here he is crying on the phone to me. You know, this married man who, like, the position of trust, the amount of trust he gave to us by phoning us in the morning, waking us up and saying, I need your help. I don't know what to do.
It's a pretty big action.
You know, and you can't, as a human, you can't ignore that. And So that night, I, like, getting all this sarcastic feedback from her that whole day, I right away, he picked me up straight from my work. I said, just come straight here. The whole day, I'm trying to just ignore this and just ignore the negative feedback I was getting and just try to be as peaceful as I can and just deal with it while still being there for him. You know, while I have this ethical dilemma, the fact that I'm being...
And you don't want to talk about it, right?
And I can't talk about it to him. Of course, kind of like what I always had to do. It was always this battle in my mind, right?
Suck it up, bitch.
Hanging out at his house and, like, just having, like, a couple drinks of gin and just having him talk it out and how much he needed that. And I remember, like, just starting to get into this place where, like, he was feeling better and I'm, like, right on. We're just playing some video games and, like... Just helping bonding him get to that point of relaxing and, you know, getting more and more calls. And I finally go into the other room and call her back and, like, well, when are you coming home? Like, when can I pick you up? And I'm like, well, like, you know, resentful that I left her the car and walked to this place. When can I pick you up? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Let me let you know in half an hour or so, you know, like literally half an hour, like saying to her, I'll just try to accommodate her still, being like, you know, I'll keep you posted. I'm just trying to make sure everything's okay because this was a really big deal for him today. And, you know, and her getting like so frustrated with me and me just like being like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm literally not going to cater to this anymore.
It's over.
I don't make decisions that rash. Said to her, I will come home and be home whenever the hell I need to because I'm doing the right thing right now. So just deal with it. You have your parents there. You're okay. You're not in any trouble, but someone, one of our closest friends is. I will be home when I need to be home. But just don't call me. I'll get back to you. I'll let you know I'm okay. You know, I'm close by. I'll find my own way home.
Leave me the fuck alone. Yeah.
So anyways, she boiled over that for a while. And I was, you know, I knew it was coming to this point. And this catalyst, you know, I remember like my good friend Jason ended up coming over. He's the one that was really there for me through all the intense stuff. And he ended up coming over to hang out with us. And, you know, like, just had a bunch of drinks. I was just like, ugh. Like, just so, what the hell am I supposed to do? Like, here, you know, I keep getting reminded of this decision I have to make.
You already knew by then what you needed to do.
I knew what I needed to do.
But you just couldn't, were you psyching yourself up for this? Were they, these were just...
No, I was psyching myself out. You're psyching myself out of it. Constantly, constantly.
So you were ready to go.
I was never confident. That's why I gave up skateboarding and BMX as a kid. I would see something I knew I could do and I'd psych myself out of it. I didn't believe in myself enough.
Otherwise, you would just do it. Is this what you're saying? Because, I mean, like, as far as I'm concerned, when you psych yourself out of something, it's because there's already a natural compulsion for you to want to do it.
Exactly, yeah. So, but at this point, and even then, I wasn't so much psyching myself out. I was just trying to figure out what the right decision was. And I was really...
But there's a point where you must have been psyching yourself to do it.
Yes, and this was the catalyst. Was when I walked into my house that night, Jason drove me home. You know, it was late. Her parents were visiting from Prince George. She was staying in the living room. Jason was like, I got to use the washroom before I go. I'm like, yeah, no, that's cool. Let's just be quiet when we go in because, like, they're probably sleeping. So I open the patio door. We're on a ground-level apartment, and I walk in, and Jason's right behind me. And there, like, as soon as I open the door, there comes a shadow from the darkness of this room, of my living room, storms towards me with the most intensely angry eyes. And it's her, and, you know, just like... Jason, get the hell out of here kind of thing. Like, just, like, immediately. But she's whispering. But she's angrily whispering. So she's, like, she's in control. She doesn't want to wake her parents. She doesn't want to show them how angry she was. But she wants some sort of vengeance. Those kind of calculated...
She wants blood.
Yeah. And so, like, Jason's just like, you know, I just turn around and see his eyes. And he's like, oh, dear Lord. You know. I turn around to close the patio door when he's going. And I just sense something in her that was like, this is done. And I sensed that something really bad was about to happen. So when I was closing the patio door and looked at Jason, I mouthed the words, wait in your car. You know, I just knew. So he walked over to his car in the parking lot. And, like, as soon as I turn around and close the door, she lunges up at me and, like, literally with two fingers, like, lunges with her arm and pokes me in the eyes and then backhands me across the face and then throws me onto the couch. And... as she's doing this.
Like, is she like
not intoxicated?
Totally no, but I mean, is she big? Is she tiny? Like,
no,
does she have
no,
power,
she's smaller
she's
than me.
Savagery.
She's smaller than me. This was just pure
savagery.
Like, right. It's not that I couldn't defend myself.
She's going for blood. You're just
I just
surprised.
Didn't want. Like, no, what I did. Well, happened? First off, I don't believe in defending myself against a woman in that kind of capacity. Like, what? I don't. You know, that's
I would
the kick first...
her right in the fucking vagina, I'll be honest.
But me being too nice, I was like, well, I can't...
Take that right
what do I do?
You,
what do
bitch.
I do? You know, so, like, she does this really quick as she's doing this. And as she, like, goes and pokes me in the eyes and slaps me across the face, she's very angrily whispering at me so as to not wake her parents. So, that first off, she was totally sober.
She's
beat and she's
whispering
in control.
You? Wow, that's really fucked
up. In control. And looks in my eyes and says, you're abusive, in this really angry, eerie tone. And I can't... Yeah, I almost wish I could capture it for music. Like,
is it this, the hate
saying,
you can see?
You're abusive as she's physically abusing me. And that was a deal breaker. I'm like, okay, well, things are getting better, they're getting worse. I obviously can't make this better because things are just getting worse. And you react to the point where you're very... with restraint and calculation, getting to the point of being physically abusive. So I'm like... I grabbed a hold of her arms when she threw me on the couch because she was still coming at me. And I just grabbed her arms and stopped her and just looked in her eyes and said, you realize what you're just doing right now. Very calmly. Like, by this point, I wasn't angry anymore because it was like...
Just transcended past that point?
I was so far past that point. I just stopped her, held her arms, looked in her eyes and said, you realize what you're doing. And she's still trying to, like, still trying to get at me, so angry, and I'm like... I've got to go. And, like, literally put on my shoes and very calmly left. And by that point, she was, like, trying to be like, no, no, come back, you can't go, screaming at me. And I got in my friend's car, and, I mean, it's hilarious, but it's so intense. But, like, for some reason, we immediately quoted Anchorman. Like, I mean, I sit down in my friend's car in his passenger seat, and he's just staring at me with these wide eyes because he just witnessed me coming out of this apartment, saw how much anger she was in, didn't see the whole thing, but saw that there was something whole, like crazy, like looks at me so worried, which is wide eyes, like,
what the fuck
holy
is happening?
Shit. And I look at him, and I'm like, well, that escalated quickly. And he's like, well, that got out of hand really fast. And I'm like, get out of here.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah,
let's go.
Got out of hand really
yeah.
Let's get the fuck out
yeah,
of here.
Yeah, let's just go. And he's driving, and I had a tiny bit of battery power left on my cell phone. You know, and I call her up. And for some reason, my initial, you know, and I think my inspiration was Kevin Spacey in American Beauty, and those moments where he realizes that he...
You don't control me anymore.
Yeah, and not in an angry... There's no revenge. No. It's just flat out... He just, like,
he's
thrives.
Liberated. He's
liberated. So liberated. And I was just so not angry at her. I was just finally like, well, there you go. There's my... That's it. I could,
see ya.
This, none of this matters. None of it ever mattered. Like I would never
Moved
do
on,
something like that
baby.
To someone else. Yeah, so I, like, call her up and... You know, at that point, I still wasn't thinking divorce. I was just thinking, I need time away. I didn't know what to do, you know. But when I called her up and my friend's driving down the road, you know, this random cold winter's night where all this is happening, you know, my friend's driving and I'm on my phone, the last, like, 30 seconds of battery power, I say to her, you don't get to poke me in the eyes. I'm like, and she's trying to scream back, and I'm like, no, 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 no. You're listening to me now. You don't get to poke me in the eyes. If you poke me in the eyes again, I'm going to go out and poke another girl. And my friend's falling over his steering wheel, trying not to laugh out loud to escalate the situation.
I think that was the right way to deal with it.
And that's all I could do. All I could do was laugh at it because it was so insane. And if I retaliated, it was just going to be messy. So all I could do was laugh at it. And from that point on, I had to finally just stand up for myself and be like, no.
But that was the beginning of now separating yourself entirely
totally.
From the community.
That's when I saw what was really exposed and what scared me the most. That's when how a firm belief like this or a firm structure could be the most dangerous.
And it's been how long since these events? 2 years?
Over 2.5 years. Almost 3 years.
But it's still, I mean, like, time speaking, these are still relatively
still recent
events.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I still went out of my way first to communicate with her honestly and lovingly and tell her, I don't know what to do. I'm not going to make a decision in a state of emotional distress. I want to separate. So according to them, even though in this point I knew, I don't think I could actually rightfully believe in this anymore if this is how people get treated. You know, I'd been through enough my whole life. So I knew in my mind, okay, this isn't for me. But I'm still going to play it by their rules because I wanted them to know I'm still taking the decision seriously. I didn't want to add to that reputation of people who run
but
away.
But obviously that's pointless.
Totally pointless.
Why even bother?
Exactly. And
they'll find a way to prove their point.
But they didn't. They never even tried. I had her own older brother look at me in the eyes, pull me aside out of a room, and say, you can't leave your wife. If she yells at you, yell at her back. If she hits you, hit her back. And he wasn't kidding.
She doesn't get it.
This was her older brother saying to me, she hit you. You're not allowed to walk away from her. You're supposed to put her in her place. And that is the most angering philosophy. That propagates so much corruption and abuse.
It's a vicious cycle.
It's so vicious. And the whole reason I left her in the first place was to not add to that cycle.
But let me tell you something, though. It does make for some pretty hot sex. Put that out there.
Just to put it on a lighter note.
Yeah. Definitely that is what I do. I have a reputation for doing that.
Fantastic. That's good. That's important.
Not taking things too 100% seriously.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to wrap it up because this is an insanely long show. I'm assuming it's only going to be edited, in the most moderate of ways.
Yeah.
I can only imagine because I don't know how else you'd do it. But the point is, this has been so this is a fairly recent separation.
Mm.
I want you just as if you could summarize for me the feeling, because, I mean, think about this. In 10 years, you're going to go back and you're going to listen to this bonus show. And
yeah.
It's going to seem weird because you're not even going to maybe remember some of the parts that you discussed. But I want you to send, remember how I said before where you have to think about things in the future? I want you to send not only a future message to yourself about how it has felt so far, but what you think it's going to be like in the future to see if you're right. So what do you have to say? Because in a sense, you're not just speaking to you.
Yeah.
You're speaking to every guy who's just been pretty much in your boat, who's just even about to, right? He's like, holy shit, I might have to take that plunge as a careful and systematic decision.
You mean to reassure a possible future self that's wondering, did I make the right choices? Are you talking along those lines? Yeah, well,
what would you say to that future self?
At this point, and I think a lot of people ask me this because it's the most logical curiosity, I think, to have talking to someone like me. Do you ever think about going back? Are you scared of going back? I think we discussed that before.
We did.
Is that I found far more comfort in uncertainty than I ever did in the idea that God will have my back at the end of the day as a kid. And that was a really naive certainty in my mind. That was, when I believed in this God as a kid, I thought for sure, like, there was no doubt. And when I decided to completely abandon that as a possibility and leave myself open to whatever may be true, I found way more comfort and way more genuine human spirit.
Well, do you want to hear my cheesy version of saying it?
Yeah.
It is only by embracing uncertainty that we have the opportunities that really shape
exactly.
us.
Exactly. And although, my past has put me at some disadvantage, I guess.
No. I think disadvantage is one of those ways where you're looking
at it the
wrong way.
Well, certain societal perceived disadvantages. Like, I don't have the family support to fall back
on. Yeah, but you're also not in a fucking third world country where your non-belief will get you killed. So what we think are disadvantages are just the genuine realities of a messy life.
I guess I digress. Although the choices I've made were not easy ones to make, right, I still find a more genuine sense of human spirit in this perceived world, quote unquote, and a sense of honesty, and that's what I find in people around me, who embrace uncertainty.
Here's how I would word it. I would word it that the spark of life seems all the more brilliant when there is no one tending the fire. It's all the more fragile and beautiful when there's no one that makes sure that the hearth stays lit. It is almost a tragedy, though, that in our life we may be the ones that extinguish it.
Completely, yeah. In our
utterly
generation.
Utterly and annihilated, yeah. We might be the ones that sort of like put out that torch. My hope, at least, is that this is not the only amber that blows.
Yeah, I guess, firstly, to my, decade from now future self, mad props for surviving the next 10 years. Like,
nicely done.
I can't.
Are you really worried about the future?
Well, no, I'm not worried about it because I think at the end of the day, as in my own experience, if anybody could cling to human spirit and honesty and have that overcome any obstacle in their path,
you would be that example of being
alive. Yeah, like if I could do it, if I could do it, anyone can. Anyone can. So I guess I believe in that humanity will evolve as it will. I don't believe that it will be extinguished.
So you're an optimist.
But in a way, but humanity's facing also probably the darkest possible times, I think, coming up. There's
it's in that time, transition. In the darkest of times.
Which is why I listen to such terrible music. Like, it's, you know, you're finding the beauty in those really, really tragic moments or those terrifying moments. And I don't think all of us will necessarily live out the next 10 years to see that. So, props for surviving.
All right. Props for future surviving. Chris. I guess that's the message at the end of the day. So, you know what? Just to wrap it up, I'd like to thank you for sharing your story. I hope that ultimately, I mean, I am putting you in a weird bind where in a limited amount of time I've asked you to edit the story of your life, but I think that in the end, it will be an interesting opportunity, and chance for you to.
Well, first off, if anybody right now has enough patience that they're still listening, I want to meet you because you're a saint.
Don't say that to everybody because then you will have to probably meet quite a few people. I get complaints that the show's not long enough. Last time is only
like, because that's what I love about music that I've been tapping into the past few years and about my perception in general is that, you know, restraint or limited. I guess, you know, the patience to explore something fully makes it that much more rewarding, you know.
It's the bonus show. You don't have to apologize for making long shows.
Yeah.
If they were worried about it, they can divide it up into two pieces.
I don't care if they don't like it because they have the stop button in the palm of their hand right now.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, I don't care. But if they're still listening, what I'm saying is, first off, I commend you and I want to talk to you. That's
you commend everyone out there for having listened to you for that long. So thanks, my everybody. Voice, yeah. Thanks everybody for having listened to us. Thanks for Chris for not only sharing his story. I really hope that the people there are people out there that are going to be motivated towards it. I know that there is someone out there that is just waiting to fucking hear what Chris had to say just because they needed to hear it. And that's the reason why I wanted to do the show. That's the reason the show is fucking as long as it needs to be, because there's no goddamn time limit on my fucking show. It goes as long as it needs to. And if you have a problem with that, you have a pause button. But I know all of you, you're like crack addicts. That's why you're listening to the fucking show. You're like, I want more. I just want more. So you can have more. Chris has given you more. So you must thank Chris. Chris is your new friend. He is my new friend. He will hopefully allow us to develop lots of cool new projects that I want to work on, so I'm going to utilize some of Chris's talent. I should
thank everyone for listening to Clips of Sound and stuff here and after, you know.
The stuff that you produced stuff in the future that we can't hear now, but we are hearing.
We're listening to right now. Exactly. Yeah. Thanks for that.
It's like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I tell you what, these time travel jokes, I fucking love them. I'd like to thank everybody that is a contributing member of the site. Thank you so much. In a couple of weeks, some of you will be receiving reminders to update your memberships, but the cool thing will be, at the same time, you're going to get some previews about some of the stuff that me and Chris are going to be working on. So look forward to that when you get your little message saying, I need more money, bitch. So that's the good news. Everybody else, that the people that have been signing up for hardcore memberships, trust me, that will pay off. We're working on so much cool bonus material that only you, the hardcore.
We're so busy.
I'm telling you.
I'm at a cider. But I'm just still working here.
It's been working for 3 hours. I'm running everyone to the bone. But I want to give you guys as much as possible.
He only bought us one bottle of cider, folks. I mean, this man needs some help.
And honestly, the hardcores, you guys have been supporting me all this time. You guys are going to be definitely reaping the benefits when everything is rolling nice and fucking fine. It's a slow process, but what can I say? I'm only one fucking man. Well, I'm not only one man.
Not anymore.
I'm one man with tons of talented friends that help me out. and hopefully we'll continue to do so. So with that, I'd like to thank my guest Chris Tentz for being on the show. We're going to
provide. Is there going to be links on?
There's going to be all kinds of links. Yeah, there's going to be on the like on that? The website. Yeah. There's going to be links. There's going to be links for the preview because you're going to also part of the thing is you have to make a 2-minute preview audio thing.
Yeah, I got to make an introduction.
Yeah, you got to make. You got to entice people.
Music at the end.
Yeah, sure.
I'm basically being more narcissistic in this 3-hour clip than I've ever been in my life. I'm going to spam myself.
If anyone can teach
any applications for marriage can be sent to chris@christentz.com.
Let me tell you something, Chris. If anyone can teach you a thing or two about narcissism, it is me.
Nice. Well, that's fantastic.
I will guide you in the way of narcissism. So great. Yes, we'll provide lots of links to your stuff. And
please support that because that's, you know, that's what I've come to do since then. Since those times of my life is, you know, organizing events and making music and yeah. So I need your help with that as well, by the way. Not just Jacob here, but we're kind of all in this together, I think.
Well, I'm only going to tell them to do so if they were really impressed by your work.
Yeah.
I will stand behind whatever the hell just happened in the future that's now.
In the future that's now. Yeah, right. Obviously. But then...
It'll be...
When?
Shut up. It'll be soon.
No.
Your deadline is soon. You've gone...
Is it?
You only got
my deadline
days.
Was Sunday yesterday? Yeah. My deadline is...
As far as everyone's concerned...
Is yesterday.
It was yesterday.
My deadline is yesterday. Okay, my deadline to get this produced.
No more time traveling jokes.
Oh, sorry.
All right, with that, I'd like to thank everybody again. In all seriousness. Thank you for listening to the show. Yeah. My name is Jacob Forte.
And thanks for having me, Kristen.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody. All right. I'll smile at our guests with the ease of 40 years of corporate slavery. Glass of wine, repeat until the laughter's flowing almost naturally. Thank you.